a single penny on student, quote, programs related to the study of greenhouse gas emissions. See if we all just don't...
Old Radio WIOO Carlisle and WEEO Shippensburg.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell... I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it into the bathroom and drown in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you?
Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here. Tonight on the program, we're going to be talking with Pennsylvania State Senator Vince Hughes about jobs. Jobs, jobs! Remember that thing Republicans were talking about for a little bit back, November 2010? In fact, they had a whole little, one of those things they love so much, those pledge thingies that they just absolutely adore, though those that they never really follow through on, except if it means, screwing the working class and handing more money to the wealthy. Yeah, but the jobs things, not so much. In fact, we haven't seen a jobs plan come out of a Republican yet, other than the same failed, tired, boring, old, failed policies of the past. More deregulation, more tax cuts for the uber wealthy, and of course more free trade that has failed us. So again, more of the same. But here again, you know, the trickle-down people, they become accustomed to trickling on us in the working class. Also in the second hour, Mike Gallagher, Eastern Region Coordinator for the American Postal Workers Union, going to be here talking about how we save our nation's postal service. Their website, saveamericaspostalservice.org, going to talk about how we turn this thing around, because this congressional mandate is really going to hurt any other business in this country. Wouldn't have to do what the Postal Service is going to have to do and ultimately take them down. And this is, again, one of those Republican ploys with the help of some Democrats to muddle that line between what is public, what is private, quasi-business, quasi-not. Really just kind of strange. They really can't compete with FedEx and UPS, not because they can't, because they're not allowed. So it'll be interesting to talk to Mike Gallagher about that. Also in the second hour, Carmeline Sherba is going to be here. Talk a little bit about pollution, the EPA, what's going on in her neighborhood. She's an activist working to keep, you know, the air that her kids breathe, you know, kind of clean. After all, she does have a couple of kids that have asthma, moved from Philadelphia out into the you know, the country there for that clean air, only to find that they're drilling and polluting the air there. And in the third hour, Mark Steer is going to be here talking about the big voucher debate he had with Senator Hardy Williams and the rest of the pro-privatization of public education clan, the well-funded clan, mind you. So that ought to be interesting. Also, your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. So you can break out the mission accomplished banner. The business community has done exactly what they've wanted. They have figured out how, it's been 40 years, but I can hear the champagne popping as we speak. The Gallup poll just released today. 81% of us dissatisfied with how our country is being governed. 81%. Both Democrats and Republicans, not happy. And why is that? I mean, you look at the all of the hostage situations that have gone on. You look at all of the things that have gone on that it just doesn't, it just looks like it's broken. It's not broken. It's being destroyed. There's a difference. Someone is actually taking a hammer to our political system. And some would say, well, you know, we have this shared political power, and, you know, we've got this partisan split. You know, that's all it is. You know, we're just having that spat. And I got to be honest, personally, I think it's a media structure unable and unwilling to place blame where it's due. And, you know, you look at all the moneyed interests in this. All the money that's in here, hell-bent on destroying this system, destroying our government that has been in place for well over 200 years. And you look at the lackeys on the radical right, who, to be honest, are less willing to compromise than my sugared-up 3-year-old who hasn't had her nap. I mean, really, at some point, the folks with the scorched earth policy, the scorched earth party, I know they're used to bullying, they're used to getting their way, they're used to, the saying we're going to draw a line in the sand and Democrats caving, they're used to it. And the reason they're used to it is because we have a for-profit corporate-controlled media structure in this country that continually gives them a pass. And anytime the Democrats stand up and say, hold on, we've caved enough, the media then says, it's both parties. No, it's not both parties. It's the party of no, the party of no vision, the party of no ideas. You go into this Gallup poll, and again, you know, it's bad news all the way down for those of us who believe in government of, for, and by we the people. It's excellent news. It's fantastic news. This is champagne, caviar. This is 4th of July. This is New Year's. This is all of that wrapped up into one big happy ball for the people who despise government. Because they've already figured out how they've got you to turn against your government. 82% of Americans disapprove how Congress is handling his job, and you look at what's going on and you cannot disagree. You've got a party who's hell-bent on scorched earth, hell-bent on destruction, and they're doing everything they can do to get you to feel this way. 69% of those polled said they have little or no confidence in the legislative branch. That is an all-time high. 57% say they have little or no confidence in the federal government's ability to solve domestic problems. Also a high. 53% have little or no confidence in anyone seeking or holding political office. So we distrust even the people who may run. I mean, it's not bad enough that we distrust the people who are holding the offices. It's even the people who may. 50, and this is another one that gets me. Americans believe on average that the federal government wastes 51 cents of every dollar it takes in. It wastes over half. I mean, that, to me, marvelous messaging. Marvelous. 49% believe that the federal government has become so large and powerful that it poses an immediate threat. An immediate threat. But corporations, not so much. I'm really, really just amazed. And you look at this latest hostage situation that has just been averted. The vote just happened. But here's the thing. You had this gridlock. You had this period where people here in central Pennsylvania are going, hey, we want to make sure that the aid is coming. We want to be able to bank on the fact that the federal government is going to help us out in our time of need. And what the Republicans did, they played on that. And they wanted the drama because the drama causes this kind of angst. Now, FEMA had about, I guess, $114 million they were claiming, which would have lasted them through the end of the week. So today wasn't the deadline. But here again, you know, all they did was push this off down the road. And understand, we will see more. We will see another hostage situation and another. Because Republicans have made it impossible to pass even the simplest legislation. And look, this is pretty simple. Help people in their hour of need. To me, that's pretty simple. We can talk about everything else later. We can talk about everything else down the road. Right now, we've got people who need help today. Help them. And I got to be honest, it kind of reminds me of those Christian missionaries who go over to, you know, third world country somewhere, and with one hand, they've got a bowl of food going, okay, here you go, put it under the nose, take it away. All you got to do is listen to me preach to you. And then they bash him over the head with the book, and then you can eat. Help the people. That's simple. And you might remember 2005. Hurricane Katrina hit. Congress came up with over $60 billion. Less than 2 weeks it took. We have had numerous billion-dollar disasters this year. And every time it seems to be some kind of bizarre thing. I mean, this latest one, the Republicans wanted to gut $1.5 billion from the Green Car Program for $1 billion to help people. It's amazing to me. And you know what's even funnier? When Herman Cain seems to be the voice of reason, when he says, I'd make sure that FEMA got the money it needed, and if I had to go find the offsets later, go find it later, he said. Stop playing with people's tragedies. These are real people we're talking about. Again, you know, when Herman Cain is the guy making sense, I don't know what to tell you. So we've had $11 billion disasters, 11 separate billion-dollar-plus disasters already. Who's to say that in this gap period, because the bill that the Senate just passed will allot no money for this fiscal year, it will then give a little bit more to next year. So what happens from now until the end of the fiscal year? Because understand, the weather is going to cost us. Whether you believe in global warming or whatever, we're having some major disasters lately. And it's going to cost us a lot of money. I mean, understand, when Jeb Bush and the moneyed interests start up private disaster response businesses, they know something's going on. They know where the money is to be found. And what's interesting to me, again, it's going back to this whole thing of blurring the lines between what we do for ourselves as a people and what private corporations do. Again, blurring that line. What do we, the people, do for ourselves through our government? And what is done for us in the name of for-profit private institutions? To me, that line gets blurred every day. The Postal Service, another example. Go down the list. FEMA next. I mean, executions. We don't even execute. Georgia doesn't even execute people anymore. They do it with private for-profit corporations. You know, I go back to Hurricane Katrina. You know, we should have gone in there and given contracts to people who were doing the work on the ground, not sent out bids for people could rebid them and rebid them. I remember the trash story. They bid the tonnage of trash out at $47 a ton. By the time they bid it down, outsourced it, independent contractor, subcontractor, by the time they got it all the way down to the guy who actually picked up the trash and took it away, they're paying $3 a ton. Is that how things get done? And the bigger point here, and to me, this is just another example of an anti-government victory. This is the Republicans agreeing to do something and then reneging on it. Because this budget thing was supposed to be done. On the other hand, this is Democrats attempting to say enough already. I mean, if you stop and think about it, is it both sides' fault? When one side continually takes the nation to the brink of disaster, the brink of destruction, to default, and the other continually gives in because they don't want disaster, they don't want default, they don't want destruction, they don't want fill in the blank. But they have to eventually say enough is enough. And Republicans think we're stupid. I really believe they think that we are stupid. And in many cases, I think maybe they're right. We are. We keep buying the frame. We keep buying that, oh, well, they're standing up for the country. No, they're standing up for the billionaire class. When they're talking about the only way that they will consider raising taxes on millionaires and billionaires is if we raise taxes on minimum wage workers, if we take away from people on Social Security, and we take Medicare away, to me, that is not compromise. That's extortion. when the only way we can increase revenue is by slashing and burning programs that help people? I'm sorry, I got a problem with that. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Pennsylvania State Senator Vince Hughes, stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. In New York City, Iron Workers Metallic Lathers Local 46 is using the federal racketeering law known as RICO to sue developers for allegedly conspiring to cheat union construction workers. Doug Cunningham reports.
The union's lawsuit accuses La Lazarian Developers, JMH Development, and the principals of HRH Construction with an illegal conspiracy to bilk union construction workers out of millions of dollars of wages and benefits. Local 46 business manager Bob Ledwith says the violation of the collective bargaining agreements here hurt both union workers and society in general.
Society itself and the taxpayer picks up all the expenses of these people, both currently and in the future, and we are deprived of the work, so we don't pay taxes. Many times they're working off the books. So this thing spirals down worse and worse, both for the American taxpayer and for the union member.
The Local 46 RICO suit against these developers alleges that the developers knowingly violated collective bargaining agreements to illegally perform millions of dollars of construction work under the guise of a phony, non-union, alter ego firm called Leviathan Construction Management. It cost union workers $7 million. If found guilty, the developers will have to pay more than $21 million.
I'm just hoping that this example resonates and others decide to say, let's see if our collective bargaining agreements have been violated and let us go forward in the example of Local 46.
It's negotiation time at Atlantic City's casinos. Workers represented by Unite Here are at the bargaining table with Caesars, Harrah's, Bally's, Showboat, and Trump Casinos. Last week was the first full week operating without a contract. The casinos are looking for substantial cuts from employees, roughly $3 per hour. They also want employees to cover some of the cost of health and pension benefits. That's a lot to ask of a workforce that has the average wage of $12 per hour. The union has counteroffered with a pay cut of 50 cents. That proposal is the first time in the negotiating history with these unions that Unite has put a concessions offer on the bargaining table. On Friday, the workers received support in the form of Teamsters President James P. Hoffa. Hoffa said in a statement that the Teamsters support Unite Here's mission to stop casinos from turning the gaming industry into an industry of poverty-level jobs. In 2004, negotiations resulted in a strike that lasted 34 days. The unions have acknowledged that striking this year would be more costly due to the ongoing economic climate.
Pacifica Radio says it's riveting. This is what democracy looks like. Wisconsin's Worker Uprising is a one-hour documentary for Madison-based Workers Independent News. Get your copy today at laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Making the blue blood see red. The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome to the new dark ages.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at TheRickSmithShow.com. If you've got a question, comment, something on your mind, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Also, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. I do answer all emails personally. Well, you know, some interesting news, and we're still trying to get a hold of Senator Vince Hughes. We'll get to him to talk about the jobs bill that the Democrats proposed today. But for me, I got to be honest. I'm looking at the Republicans imploding right before our very eyes. There's a lot of stuff coming down the line, and I'm glad they've decided to do something as insane as this election gimme, this big rig, this scheme to steal the electors away. Remember last week we talked about this group, All Votes Matter, that they're going to spend $300,000 this year lobbying for this ripoff to take place. And I love what the one guy said, one of the lobbyists said, well, you know, we really can't tell you who the donors are. We really can't tell you because, well, you know, state law doesn't make us. And there's part of me that says, you know, we need a law. We need something to say who is behind all of this stuff. But what's going on is the Republicans across the country are going, well, wait a minute, this is not good. This is bad messaging. And the majority of Republican congressional members here in the state, not happy either. In fact, they held a 45-minute meeting with some senators down here in Harrisburg to say, hey, look, stop it. Drop the voter ID bill. Drop the Electoral College change bill. Drop all that stuff. Stop it. I hope they continue, and I hope they keep banging their head against the wall, because maybe they'll stop doing the other destructive stuff, and people will wake up and realize exactly what they're doing. Now, look, the congressional delegation, they know what's going to happen. They know that they're going to get picked off one by one. And, you know, part of me says, good, go, let's give it a shot. Because this massive overreach, this massive theft of one of the core tenets of our democracy. I remember when the tea twizzlers were here in town fighting against the Employee Free Choice Act, going, oh, every vote matters, the sanctity of the ballot box. Well, this is changing all this. This election rig, this big rig is shameless. It's nothing more than a shameless ripoff. But, you know, I guess what do you expect? I mean, it's a power grab. And again, this is why I'm against one party rule. And unfortunately, the party that's in control has no vision, no plan, no clue, no idea how to get us out of the economic situation we're in, no idea how to move the country or the state forward. So what they have to do to keep power is to lie, cheat, and steal. If you can't win fair and square, you gotta cheat. It's just that simple.
Well, here's the problem with it, Rick. And we discussed this last week. Here's the problem. The Republicans could have the shoe on the other foot. What if the Republicans had the numbers? And anything's possible in politics. Then what you did is really put your own party in a corner. This is very, very, the Republicans are taking one heck of a chance. Now, as to where the money comes from, could it be from Alec? Or at the very least, could it be from one of the multi-billionaire right-wingers.
Which is why we absolutely need a law. Brothers. We absolutely need to have a law to say who's funding what.
I mean, it smells, if it looks like a duck and quacks like a duck, it's a duck. And it smells awful similar to a lot of other bills that have been sponsored by those people.
Well, we absolutely need, and I think a bill has to put forth to find out where this money is coming from. We've got to know who's buying who. And I look at a report today and talking about the super committee I don't think they're going to ever come to an agreement, but there was a report released today by Public Campaign and the National People's Action. And it went through and it looked at the 12 on the super committee and looked at how much money they got from finance, how much the money they got from the real estate industry, how much they got from the insurance industry, you know, who filled whose pockets. And the super 12, the super duper committee, do you know how much money they got from these three industries? Over $56 million. In fact, nearly $41 million just from the finance sector alone. You know, you go through and you read this thing, and man, it's just amazing. And they got big bucks from J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, big bucks. And you look, since 2000, the financial sector has spent over $4 billion. $4 billion in 10 years lobbying our elected officials. I'm sorry, that's a bit excessive. And the reality is that these 12... there are at least 27 current or former aides who have lobbied for the financial sector. I mean, stop and think. Are you really going to come out with anything that benefits you and me? Is there anything in this super committee that's going to help us? No, we're going to get the big screw job because they've already said, and look, I'm amazed at the people who have come out and said, wow, you know, we need shared sacrifice, and the only way we'll allow Social Security to be cut is if we raise taxes on the wealthy. No. No, 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 no. Understand how bad we've been screwed in this country. How bad the working class of this country has taken it on the chin. The poverty rates are going through the roof. The billionaire class has never had it so good. Not even during the Gilded Age did they have it this good. And they don't want to let go. I mean, it's just amazing to me. And it's Democrats and Republicans. It's in both of them. They go through and they throw out some numbers. Max Baucus, the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, the biggest winner of the finance sector's largesse, $6.2 million. Kerry took 6.1. John Kyle from Arizona, Republican, 5.2. Portman, Republican from Ohio, 4.6 million. Harmsling, the Republican from Texas, 3.9 million. Our boy Pat Toomey, $3.4 million. Dave Camp, Republican from Michigan, almost $3 million. Patty Murray, Democrat from Washington, $2.5 million. And what we're seeing is, look, the financial sector, they don't care. They'll buy both parties. They'll buy both sides. There's a lot to go around because they're making tons of money. The reality is we need jobs. Cuts aren't going to cut it. Cuts are only going to put us in worse shape. Cuts are only going to make our economy worse. I mean, I am amazed that we don't have people marching in the street everywhere like those people in New York, the Occupy Wall Street movement there. There should be an Occupy every street in this country. Until they turn this thing around and start saying, okay, well, you know, we need to let the cash flow a little bit down. We've starved the proletariat long enough. So Mike Doyle, representative from here in Pennsylvania, he's going to introduce a piece of legislation, the American Energy Infrastructure and Manufacturing Jobs Act. He says it's a complement to the president's American Jobs Act. Doyle said the legislation proposed by the president, it focuses on the macroeconomic policies, lowering payroll taxes, tax breaks for business investment, reforms to unemployment, things like that. Doyle says his act focuses specifically on manufacturing, construction, and energy technology. And, you know, there are some very good jobs bills out there. The Democrats have come up with some really good legislation. And the sad thing is it's a shame that the Republicans will not allow it to come to a vote, will not allow it to go anywhere. They're going to bottleneck it up for their political gamesmanship. Remember last week we talked about the Senate passing the Trade Adjustment Assistance Bill? In fact, the Senate, 70-27, pretty amazing. Then what happened? Well, you had John Boehner come out and say, well, you know what? We'll consider it, maybe. We'll think about it. We'll talk about it. Only after Obama submits those free trade agreements with Colombia, South Korea, and Panama. Only then. So again, a step forward. We're going to help people when we lose all these jobs. And you've got the Republicans saying, nope, political gamesmanship first. And very childish ways is that. No, you first. And again, not moving forward. Another piece of legislation that I think is pretty promising, the Currency Exchange Rate Oversight Act. Again, we've lost more than 2.8 million jobs since we've been dealing with the Chinese. And most of it, currency manipulation, pretty simple. And they're claiming if we just let the yuan hit equilibrium, an increase of about 28.5%, we would see job growth here. We would see the leveling of the trade imbalance. And they're saying it could create over almost 2.25 million jobs. There's a lot it can do. Personally, I think a bill that I would like to see, and I'm still very hopeful, is one that helps workers organize. I look at our friends over at the Center for American Progress Action Fund, David Madlin, who we've had on this program a number of times. Him and his partner, Nick Bunker, came up with some numbers and found that if unionization rates in this country were increased by just 10 percentage points, That would mean a 22.2% unionization rate here in the country. The average middle-class household would earn about $1,500 a year more. What would that do for our economy? What would that do for a consumer-based economy? $1,500 more in the hands of people who spend almost every penny that they earn. What would that do? I think it would create an awful lot of jobs. I think it would do an awful lot to get this economy moving. We can only give millionaires and billionaires so much. They can only spend so much so fast. You ever see the movie Brewster's Million, Jake?
No, I don't believe it did.
Richard Pryor, John Candy, great movie. Richard Pryor has an old uncle, Uncle Rupert, white guy, dies. Leaves him, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars if he can spend $30 million in 30 days. So but the catch is, because anybody goes, I can spend $30 million in 30 days, that's no problem, right? But you can have nothing at the end of the 30 days. That's the premise. You have to actually consume that $30 million. And he finds it's pretty damn hard. But if you were to give that $30 million to 30 different people, what would you have? You'd have a much easier time. And if you did 30 million people, it would be that much simpler. And you'd get the economy moving. Anyway, let's take a quick break. We'll take your calls after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
The Rick Smith Show.
Wow, someone must have slipped a dose of special Viagra to Barack Obama, for his backbone has suddenly stiffened. Finally showing a bit of real populist fervor, the president drew a line in the sand for plutocratic congressional Republicans. He declared that he would veto any deficit plan that cuts Medicare but lets multimillionaires keep paying a lower tax rate than middle-class families. He called for a minimal tax hike on those making more than $1 million a year, an uptick that would affect fewer than 450,000 privileged Americans who can easily absorb the increase. Oh, the operatic screams of agony from the chorus of Republican harpies in Congress. So jolted were they by the very idea that the rich would be required to share our nation's budgetary burden that they raced to the barricades of wealth, from which they lobbed rhetorical firebombs at Obama. Class war, shrieked the GOP's House Budget Chairman, Representative Paul Ryan. For Ryan to utter that phrase is such gross hypocrisy that I'm amazed he didn't gag on the words, choke, and expire on the spot. This is, after all, the guy who rammed a budget through the House this spring that would have killed Medicare for America's seniors while protecting the multi-billion dollar subsidies for big oil. How classy is that? Ryan and party have consistently voted for policies that have held down the poor, knocked down middle-class income, and shoved practically all of the wealth created in America during the past decade straight uphill into the pockets of the super-rich. That, Mr. Ryan, is classic class war. This is Jim Hightower saying, Obama nailed the GOP's whine for the poppycock it is, noting that his proposal, quote, is not class warfare, it's math. Yes, and it's something else, too, something essential for a democratic society, it's basic fairness.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
Bringing sanity and rational thought back to America. Rick Smith.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. So this morning, the state Senate Democrats rolled out their jobs plan. And, you know, I think I need my Wayback Machine, but I seem to remember something, you know, last November, something around jobs, something in the 2010 election, one of those pledges that Republicans are so fond of. one of those pledges. It was something along jobs, jobs, jobs. It was a good slogan. Nothing ever came out of it, but a good bumper sticker slogan. Well, today the Democrats rolled out their jobs plan. PA Works Now is the name of it, a plan that seeks to create some 80,000 jobs. And here to talk to us about it is State Senator Vince Hughes. He is the Democratic Appropriations Chair. Senator, thanks for taking time for me.
Hey, Rick, how you doing this evening, man?
I'm good. How's this going to work? How are we going to create 80,000 new jobs?
Well, you know, first, Rick, it doesn't raise any taxes, and basically what it does is it takes money that, quite frankly, is already in the pipeline and pushes it out early. Right now, for example, Rick, there's about $500 million that exists over at a program called PennVest that operates at the state level, which deals with infrastructure issues, especially around water and sewer. And what we're saying is that we need to drive that. Let's not wait for any amount of time. Let's drive that money out now right into the system. Let's put money out into the water and sewer systems, which, as you know, Rick, across the state are crumbling all over the place. We have some major cities and some smaller communities, Rick, where almost 50% of the water that flows through those systems is leaking out of holes and cracks and what have you. We're losing tremendous amount of water, tremendous amount of water supply. So, long story short, drives money out, takes excess money, projected surpluses that are in that the governor's projecting for the end of this fiscal year, puts them into activity right now. And then finally, what it does, Rick, is it takes a piece of the Marcellus Shale money, which we really need to get. You know, as you know, right now there's no taxes or fees or anything on Marcellus Shale.
Yeah, thanks to the pledge.
It's thanks to the pledge. That's Grover Norquist. That's his crew. You know, it takes a piece of that money and puts it in financing for infrastructure programs, not just in physical infrastructure programs, Rick, but it also puts it in technology infrastructure. We have believe it or not, the country which essentially invented the Internet now is starting to trail behind in terms of its level of technology and the infrastructure system that's utilized to get that technology out to people. So it's green stuff, it's infrastructure stuff, both in the dirt and on the ground, it's infrastructure stuff in technology. It raises no taxes, and it uses money that's currently in the system and kind of jump-starts that money and gets it out in the system right now. We can create about 80,000 jobs all across the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, begin the process of rebuilding our aged infrastructure, which, as you know, are the keys to economic development and innovation, and then just really do what the people of the Commonwealth are looking for us to do. You know, we all knew that jobs was the number one issue, but I kind of think that, you know, when we adjourned back in June and spent the summer, and this is Democrat and Republican senators and legislators, spent the summer back in that district, you start, you know, really, you know, at community meetings and block meetings and neighborhood meetings and out at the fair and at the park and what have you, wherever you go, during the course of the summertime, legislators heard clearly that our constituents are really in a desperate situation in terms of their own personal economic security.
Yeah, but it's been that way for, you know, a good two years now. And
oh,
yet...
no question about it, Rick. I mean, you're absolutely on point as far as that's concerned. I think the point that we're trying to get across to people is that we can't wait any longer. We've got to pass a jobs bill or a series of jobs bill now that rebuilds the infrastructure, rebuilds communities, rebuilds neighborhoods, gives people some hope, and puts people back to work so they can get some money in their pocket, pay their bills, and help revitalize their own communities.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. I mean, you brought up the waters and the sewer pipes. Most of that stuff 70, 80 years old, an investment that has been allowed to crumble beneath our feet. But here again, the word investment seems to be something, especially when it's public investment, something that your colleagues on the other side of the aisle don't seem to be all that interested in.
Well, you know, look, it's basic. It's basic. It's kind of like economics 101. And any economist worth his salt, Krugman and all of those guys will tell you that the keys to any community, any constituency moving forward is you make investments in education, you make investments in infrastructure, you know, you create environments so that, you know, the travel and business of commerce can move easily. And that creates smarter communities, and that creates communities that can be much more productive. And that's economics 101. And so here we have, and that's the government's responsibility to do that. What we believe is that when the government does this, then it'll draw private sector dollars off the sidelines and back into the business of putting people back to work. You know, one of the pieces that we talk about is similar to what the president has talked about, which is a subsidy for every job that's created by the private sector, especially if you're in a small employment situation. If you're a small business, you know, $1,000 subsidy for every new job that's created in targeted businesses. You know, that'll bring the private sector dollars back into the mix, because you know as well as I do, the private sector money is sitting on the sidelines. They got a whole nother game that they're playing. You know, I've got my speculation about that, but that's another show you and I need to have. But, you know, they got their money on the sidelines. We have to figure out ways to draw that money off the sidelines and back into economic flow, give some money to some small businesses, let them create some jobs, they get a basic subsidy out of that, and that starts to turn the economy again, and then people go back to work.
Well,
but it's got to be priority now, Rick. It's got to be priority one now. We have to be in the business of creating jobs now. This is there's been a lot of other conversations going on in Harrisburg. A lot of distractions is going on in Harrisburg. You know, voter ID and electoral college and things like that. In many respects, it's got a lot of people heated, a lot of people excited, a lot of people upset. But it's not about the business of creating jobs. And many of us believe that it's all a big distraction.
Yep.
A political distraction. And it's taken everybody off the mark dealing with the number one issue, which is about putting people back to work.
Now, I've been saying that all since it broke. Look, this is telling me that the Republicans don't have a clue of what to do next. No vision, no idea, no clue. So we need to create this little shiny thing for people to focus on while they're not creating jobs. So I'm glad that somebody's doing something, but I look at a lot of this stuff that's in this, and I go, well, why haven't we done it to this point? And then what are the chances of getting this through? After all, Pennsylvania, I know you know better than anyone, a plan from a Democrat not going to get much support. How much do you think you're going to get out of this?
Well, look, Rick, it's our job to put the concepts out there. And, you know, we did some basic tenets, you know, which was, you know, no new taxes. We're dealing with money that's already in the system, money that's already in the loop, some of the money that comes from the federal government. We utilize it, we tweak it a little bit differently. We create some efficiencies in the programs that are already operating. Some of the economic development programs in the Commonwealth don't really work that well, Rick. So we take those dollars, we move it from those programs, and we put it into some other programs. We take the projected surplus, and we utilize it as a means to finance some investments in these kinds of programs. And you take the Marcellus Shell money. Now, everybody said, you know, even the governor started to budge a wee little bit on this issue, wee little, okay, about trying to get money from Marcellus Shell to do some investments in different communities. We think that one of the means to that is that it needs to, as I said earlier, needs to be put into a Pennsylvania investment bank and a Pennsylvania infrastructure bank. You utilize that vehicle to do some creative financing, which is not rocket science stuff. It's done all the time. And you put more money, make more money available, and you start putting people back to work.
Yep.
It's easy. It's simple. It's not complicated. Now, the question is going to be, is if we can raise, if the broader community can raise enough, you know what, to force these guys to take a look at this stuff and try to make some of these things happen.
You know, the truth of the matter is I'm looking through this. A lot of this looks like public-private investment stuff, the investment bank, all of that. This is stuff Republicans have been for historically in the past. I don't see a reason why they shouldn't be for it now.
Well, we're going to keep forcing the issue, man. And you know, I appreciate on behalf of the Senate Democratic Caucus, I appreciate, you know, what you've been as a vehicle to help get the word out to folks who may not necessarily have access to the message about how we've got to put the people of the Commonwealth first. You know, folks are really, really struggling.
Yep.
And I'm not sure, you know, sometimes we get lost in the statistics. We get lost in the numbers and what have you. But, you know, when you go out and you talk to families and individuals who are trying to make ends meet, and, you know, a husband and a wife who are raising their own family, but then, you know, they find out that they've got difficulties and, you know, one of their cousins or other family members, extended family members, is having problems, and, you know, they got to move the kids from one state to the other, and this family takes on these extra kids, and, you know, the dad is not, you know, he's not really working, he's not making too much money, but they try to do the right thing, they play by the rules, you know. We are our brother's keeper. We are our sister's keepers. Everybody's looking out for one another. And these are folks who are struggling. These are American citizens. All right? These are the people who are the backbone of this country, the backbone of the state. These are the people who we deserve and we should be standing up for trying to help them through this very difficult environment.
I agree.
They did not create this problem, Rick, and I don't mean to start yelling, buddy, but they didn't create this problem. The average working Pennsylvania citizen, but the average person in Pennsylvania did not create this problem. But we're the ones, they're the ones who are suffering the hardest as we try to figure out our way through this. We need to help them get back on their feet, and it's our job to do it.
Absolutely, and I want people angry. I want people raising their voice. Don't ever be ashamed of that. I mean, this is a situation that you got the right to be pissed off about, and everybody who's lost their job has the right. Like you said, they didn't create this. They're just suffering from it. The people who created this have never done better than they're doing right now.
Exactly. And the guys who created the situation got the bailout from the federal government, the Wall Street guys, they got the bailout. I know you saw the movie Too Big to Fail, and you probably even read the book. And, you know, the end of the movie was so telling when Bernanke stood up there and said, well, we'll give these bankers the money, and we anticipate that they'll spend it. And it's like, wait a minute, didn't you put any rules and regulations that required you to spend the money?
Nope.
And, you know, what they did is they didn't spend the money, they pocketed it, and they're making the largest record personal profit in the history of the industry. The average person walking around trying to make ends meet, you know, the person that mom and dad that's at the laundromat right now while you and I are talking, trying to, you know, they can't afford to wash and dry at home, so they're trying to, you know, wash their clothes and get everything ready for their kids to go to school tomorrow and you know, trying to, you know, keep everything together. They didn't cause this problem. They didn't cause this problem, but we got to stand up for them.
Absolutely.
And it's our job, and that's what PA Works Now is all about. Standing up for the average person, trying to help them out through this very difficult circumstance.
And what would you tell people to do? I say call your representative and scream loudly.
Well, you know, that's what it is. It is not complicated, Rick. Call the governor, call your senator, call your legislator, and say, look, we want to work now. We like PA Works Now. Let's move this legislation. Let's move it now. Let's not wait. We can't wait any longer. Stop the foolishness. Stop the distraction politics. The politics of diversion. Let's start dealing with some policies and we're going to put people to work, and we need to support this legislation right now.
Last question I've got for you. You know, I was looking today for a jobs plan from the governor or from any of the Republicans. Are there any, or am I missing?
None. Haven't seen any. Haven't seen any, Rick. Yeah, haven't seen any. Look, the unemployment rate in May was 7.4%. Now, at the end of August, it's 8.2%. The governor has not put a jobs program together. His representative made a statement today that, you know, we just feel that if you create a better tax climate in Pennsylvania, keep taxes low on everybody, that'll create jobs. Well, you know as well as I do, Rick, that that's no automatic job creator right there. You know that. That's, you know, again, economic policy 101 teaches you that you got to create specific incentives that create an environment so people can go back to work.
You know, if tax cuts and handouts to the very wealthy were the panacea, the Bush years would have been the best years in history.
Yeah, exactly. But they weren't. They weren't. It's when we had targeted, thoughtful economic policy where everybody paid their fair share, that's when things worked out. The Clinton administration in those 8 years under Bill Clinton, I think are a clear example of how this whole process works. And when you get in an environment, where things are really tough, the greatest recession since the Great Depression, you better look back to old Franklin Roosevelt and see what he was doing, because that had a way and a willingness to work for people.
That's it. Put people back to work. Senator Hughes, I appreciate the time. Please come back anytime. As this is moving forward, we'd like to get some updates from you.
We'll do that, Rick. Thanks a lot, man. Take care of yourself.
Thanks so much. We're going to take a quick break. Right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Right back.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
With a PSECU home equity line of credit, you can use the equity in your house to pay for things you want. Whether it's a trip to the beach, a new deck for fun summer parties, or a little consolidation to get your bills in order, we've got a rate so low, you'll want to raise the roof. A 3.25 annual percentage rate will fit into any budget. Additional rates and terms are available. Summer's a great time to start knocking off items on your to-do list. Replace the gutters that didn't survive the storms. Make over your kitchen with new paint and energy-efficient appliances. Or maybe it's time to add a deck so you can enjoy your staycation in style. We've got fast approvals, no appraisal or credit report fee, and no prepayment penalties. Financing light is what we do best, so talk with us. For additional rates and terms, call 800-LOAN-555 or go to pseCU.com/life.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We make history happen!
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
What they do?
Stock traders, stock traders. No, not working for you. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website at the RickSmithShow.com. I'll get it out eventually. Speaking of stock traders, this Aliso Ratini, he told the BBC today that traders were actually looking forward to the possibility of a second big recession. He said, for most traders, it's not about, we don't really care about how things are going to get fixed. We don't care about the economy. We don't care about fixing the whole situation. He said, our job is to make money from it. He said, personally, I've been dreaming for this moment for 3 years. He said, I go to bed every night and I dream of another recession. He said, when the market crashes, if you know what to do, if you have the right plan set up, you can make a lot of money from it. Rastini also said that Goldman Sachs rules the world. And I got to be honest, you look what they did in Greece. I don't know that you can make much of an argument against it. Anyway, let's go to the phone lines. Got Stosh on line one. How you doing tonight, Stosh?
All right, Rick. How you doing today?
I am great.
The senator spoke things that we know are not going to happen. It's not going to happen because these Republicans are dead set on doing nothing until the election.
Yep.
So no matter how much we cry and scream about getting something done, the only way to get something done is going down there with some Louisville sluggers and start slugging away at these people.
I don't know that that's going to get you much other than locked up.
Oh, it'll give it a wake-up call.
You look what they're doing to those the hippies in New York, spraying them with pepper spray and throwing them and beating them. Look, you're not going to beat the police state. Not going to happen. What you've got to do is you've got to have public opinion on your side. And the more we talk about these jobs plans that Democrats are putting out, and there are a lot of them, there's a lot of good legislation out there that, to be honest, as you've pointed out, going nowhere. And this is what we have to keep reminding people. Look, the Democrats have put out good plans, good, solid, workable plans. And the Republicans, who used to be in favor of all the things that are on the table, are now against it for purely one reason. They want to be president.
And they'll screw everybody else to get there, which they are doing right now.
Yep.
So they're getting plenty of money from these corporations to say no to everything that goes forth. They're getting paid day by day to say no, day by day. That's what I believe.
And even if we do elect them out, trust me, they're going to get paid. They're going to get their little cushy gig at the little think tank. The billionaire class will take care of their useful idiots. I mean, look at Rick Santorum. Got a nice cushy job working for some policy institute, making a couple hundred grand a year. Can't beat that. Can't beat it. And this is why you and I have to stand up and fight back against it and talk to our neighbors and talk to our friends and say, look at what they're doing. Point it out. If you got a T-Twit in your neighborhood, say, hey, T-Twit, look what they're doing.
We have to really fight for real. We need to go down there and show them that we're for real.
Yeah, well.
I mean, we ain't got to slug with us back, but let them see that, hey, these people are for real. They are upset. They might. Probably won't, but they might think about doing something because they're set on not doing anything whatsoever just to make the president look bad. And with the changing of election laws and rules, they're really telling us we don't give a daggone about you.
Yeah,
we're
going
to do what we're doing.
You know, Stosh, it's more than just about our president. It's about government. It's about government of, for, and by we, the people that they hate. They want corporate control. They want that oligarchy, that handful of corporate elites controlling what's going on. It's that simple.
Yep. Okay, Rick.
Appreciate the call, Stosh.
All right.
And, you know, to be honest, I mean, you listening to the stock trader, is it any surprise? They want another collapse. There's a lot. When you have that kind of turmoil, there's a lot of wealth to be had. And you know what happens to that wealth? That wealth that you and I used to have? That wealth that they want to take our Social Security money and put it into the stock market, they want to steal all that. That's where all this stuff happens. And the traders know that. Wall Street understands it. And they're looking forward to it with glee and great anticipation. It's that simple, man.
Well, I think the old adage, Rick, how much is enough? One more dollar. The answer is there never is enough.
Yeah, and you look at this. I mean, you know, Bloomberg was on Meet the Depressed on Sunday, and he's, you know, he said, well, you know, he was asked about Buffett, saying, you know, hey, tax me more because, you know, the wealthy in this country need to pay more taxes. Well, he said, no, that's just theatrics. He said, if you're going to raise taxes, you have to raise taxes on everybody. So that minimum wage worker who doesn't have a dime to spare, we're going to raise their taxes at the same rate that we're going to raise the billionaires' taxes. Understand, the Bloombergs, the Buffetts, the Gates, these people live in worlds that you and I as working people cannot fathom. I mean, I went to a party recently of people well out of my class. In fact, you know, the person who threw the party owns a basketball team, owns an NBA franchise. And just amazing amounts of wealth and opulence and really just, and it's right out under your nose. These are two very, very different worlds. So when you say, well, you know, I don't want to raise taxes on the wealthy, trust me, they have it. That's where the wealth of this country is concentrated. Where it used to be spread out amongst all of us, it's now at the very top. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Yeah.
Rick Smith Show.
The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
In New York City, Iron Workers Metallic Lathers Local 46 is using the federal racketeering law known as RICO to sue developers for allegedly conspiring to cheat union construction workers. Doug Cunningham reports.
The union's lawsuit accuses Lalazarian Developers, JMH Development, and the principals of HRH Construction with an illegal conspiracy to bilk union construction workers out of millions of dollars of wages and benefits. Local 46 business manager Bob Ledwith says the violation of the collective bargaining agreements here hurt both union workers and society in general.
Society itself and the taxpayer picks up all the expenses of these people, both currently and in the future, and we are deprived of the work, so we don't pay taxes. Many times they're working off the books. So this thing spirals down worse and worse, both for the American taxpayer and for the union member.
The Local 46 RICO suit against these developers alleges that the developers knowingly violated collective bargaining agreements to illegally perform millions of dollars of construction work under the guise of a phony, non-union alter ego firm called Leviathan Construction Management. It cost union workers $7 million. If found guilty, the developers will have to pay more than $21 million.
I'm just hoping that this example resonates and others decide to say, let's see if our collective bargaining agreements have been violated and let us go forward in the example of Local 46.
It's negotiation time at Atlantic City's casinos. Workers represented by Unite Here are at the bargaining table with Caesars, Harrah's, Bally's, Showboat, and Trump Casinos. Last week was the first full week operating without a contract. The casinos are looking for substantial cuts from employees, roughly $3 per hour. They also want employees to cover some of the cost of health and pension benefits. That's a lot to ask of a workforce that has the average wage of $12 per hour. The union has counteroffered with a pay cut of 50 cents. That proposal is the first time in the negotiating history with these unions that Unite has put a concessions offer on the bargaining table. On Friday, the workers received support in the form of Teamsters President James P. Hoffa. Hoffa said in a statement that the Teamsters support Unite Here's mission to stop casinos from turning the gaming industry into an industry of poverty-level jobs. In 2004, negotiations resulted in a strike that lasted 34 days. The unions have acknowledged that striking this year would be more costly due to the ongoing economic climate.
Pacifica Radio says it's riveting. This is what democracy looks like. Wisconsin's Worker Uprising is a one-hour documentary for Madison-based Workers Independent News. Get your copy today at laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News.
Not right wing, just race. The Rick Smith Show.
I work for the state now, helping kids with disabilities. I love the work. Making rules for bosses and you would believe. We had layoffs again this morning. I got my children now that I can see. Parents are angry, how can I blame them? They end up blaming me. When did I become the problem? How did folk become all mine? Governor says, tightening their belt.
That sure seems to be the case. You know, they talk about shared sacrifice. The only people I see sacrificing are senior citizens, children, the poor. It's amazing stuff. I guess that's what happens when you control the message and you control the media. The same thing with this whole postal situation. I just mind-blowing to me. That you have a party in this country and a number of other folks who want to see the demise of the U.S. Postal Service. Tomorrow, they have designated September 27th tomorrow as the Postal Employees Day of Action to save the Postal Service. They've got a website, saveamericaspostalservice.org. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. I've got Mike Gallagher on the line, Eastern Region Coordinator for the American Postal Workers Union. Mike, thanks for taking time for me.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Rick.
You know, I look at this, and again, to me, it tells me that there are some people out that just wanted to destroy the Postal Service, privatize it, and cut it off for the investor class, if you will.
Well, there's no doubt about that. The guy that we're calling, or at least I'm calling, the evil ISA, that Darrell Issa, a Republican congressman out of San Diego, California, has introduced a bill that would do exactly that, cut back from six-day delivery to five-day, cut $1 billion worth of infrastructure, postal infrastructure, that being our mail processing facilities, and then another billion in retail facilities. I don't know where people will get their opportunities to take advantage of using the postal service. And then, of course, you know, like the other state organizations are attacking workers' collective bargaining rights, ICE's bill also says that we would be required to renegotiate our collective bargaining agreements as far as wages, benefits, and working conditions to ensure, in his view, the Postal Service would be more of a viable entity. But we see it as the actual, you know, death of the Postal Service. And yep. The interesting thing is, in order to get bills considered, you look for co-sponsors. He's got exactly one co-sponsor for this bill, yet he's in charge of the committee that oversees the Postal Service, and he's voted, he's had his Republican-dominated committee vote that bill out of committee and onto the House floor. So we're anxiously awaiting that getting defeated, if not in the Congress, hopefully in the Senate.
Right. Let me ask you this, you know, because I hear an awful lot, there's an awful lot of talk out there, oh, the Postal Service is broke, oh, the, we're going to have to bail them out like we did the banks. Is there any truth to that?
There's absolutely no truth to it. In fact, the Postal Service has never relied on taxpayer monies to fund its massive operations, and it really is a wonderful business if you think about all the postal installations in the United States that employ all kinds of people that move. Currently, our volumes are down because of the recession, but 165 billion pieces a year and delivered 6 days a week from 220,000 vehicles. It really is the most efficient postal service on the planet for the cheapest price, 44 cents, and all of that is paid for by stamps and postal product sales. No taxpayer money whatsoever.
So you're not losing the billions of dollars that I keep hearing. Oh, they're hemorrhaging money. It's those greedy, overpaid workers. You know, it's just a drain. That's not the case.
That's what the Tea Party people would like you to believe. But actually, the Congress created the problem that we currently have financially. In 2006, they passed a Postal Accountability and Enhancement Act that required the pre-funding of retiree health benefits to the tune of $60 billion over an aggressive 10-year period. And if we didn't have that, and no other corporation in the country has that requirement, if we didn't, we would be in the black all these years, including today.
So this pre-funding, how far into the future does this pre-funding of pensions go?
The pre-funding requires us to pre-fund for retirees for 75 years.
75 years?
Paid off, 75 years. But to have it paid off within a 10-year period by 2016, the law passed in 2006, and it's just a ridiculously aggressive rate.
So conceivably, you're going to be paying for pensions for people who aren't even working for you or probably not even born yet.
That's exactly right. Exactly right. People that aren't even born yet will have prepaid their retiree health benefits.
Well, I want to work for the post office, if that's the case.
Well, in the interim, in order to meet this aggressive pre-funding, you know, the Postmaster General and all the unions have tried to get a law passed, H.R. 1351, which is the Postal Service Pension Obligation Recalculation and Restoration Act, which provides for, many people don't know this either, Rick, is that postal employees have overpaid their retirement accounts, the Civil Service Retirement Account. By actuarials estimate, we had two actuarials, one OPM did, by 50 to 75 billion.
Wow.
And we've asked, boy, can we just use that overpayment to pay this pre-funding requirement that Congress has saddled us with? And of course, that bill has, as of this morning, 215 co-sponsors, 25 of them being Republicans. But, of course, we can't get that bill out of ICE's committee because he's the chairperson of the committee. He favors his own bill that has one co-sponsor that would destroy the Postal Service. Out of this bill that has, you know, bipartisan support, which would cure the Postal Service economic ills.
To steal a line from Johnny Dangerously, the movie, what an ice hole.
how accurate.
I just, you know, again, you know, you look at this, are there any other companies, any other, even any public sector industries that have to do what you guys are being required to do? Anybody?
There's no one that we're aware of in the United States of America, public or private corporation, that's required to pre-fund their health benefits for retirees at this overwhelming. They don't do it to begin with, and if they do it, it's in such incremental, short-term fashions that, you know, this is obviously by design that they that 2006 law that was signed into law under Bush may have been intended to have this effect on the business so that it create that view
that crisis
distorted in a public's mind that the Postal Service isn't the best corporation in the world as far as efficient delivery of mail at the cheapest price.
Well, tell me it's not true. The Bush administration and the Republicans creating a crisis so later on they could destroy something that helps working people. Wow, say it's not true.
I wish I could.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're with Mike Gallagher, Eastern Region Coordinator for the American Postal Workers Union. They've got a website, saveamericaspostalservice.org. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Mike Gallagher's name. It'll take you right there. You know, I look at this, and for me, it's this kind of blurring, again, of what is public, what is private. To me, I think the Republicans want to do away with the Postal Service so that the FedExes and the, maybe not do away with it, but hamper it enough that it then becomes dependent on those for-profit industries and then raises the prices for people like me who depend on the Postal Service to get my mail and some business stuff as well.
Well, it's interesting that more entities are coming out of the woodwork. The mailing industry has their own council, and they've come out in support of 1351 because they don't want to have an overwhelmingly difficult delivery system. They know that we have universal service now that that is at a real reasonable price, and they can get their product to their customer without instability. They don't know what the Republicans have planned for them. But the interesting thing is tomorrow's rally is really to educate the public. It's really get them to understand exactly where we're at, to grab as much media attention throughout the United States that we can, because we have we're not calling these protests. It's a rally in every congressional district in the United States, all 335 of them. So our intention is to thank those that have co-sponsored the bill and to request those that haven't co-sponsored 1351 to get on board, because it's the responsible thing to do. Because the Postal Service, quite frankly, by this Friday, the economists say the Postal Service will actually be broke and not be able to pay its bills. And it's up to its borrowing limit of $15 billion, which is also a requisite of that 2006 Bush law that you only borrow up to a certain level. Well, we don't want to borrow and pay interest. We have money in our other accounts that could be shifted to make the Postal Service viable as could be.
As any other company could do. Again, I'm listening to this. I'm saying, is this another one of these Republican hostage situations? You're telling me Friday you go broke. What happens Saturday?
That's the question. Exactly what isn't going to get paid from there? The Postmaster General has indicated that employees will be the last entities that don't get paid, but we're hoping for some immediate congressional relief. And you know how bipartisan things are and what gridlock that we're facing in Washington. We're hopeful that they act and act responsibly, but that's hoping against hope.
Yeah, I mean, I'm listening to this and I'm going, you know, we just averted a hostage situation here for the end of the week. But now, you know, the House is out. I guess the Senate is going to be leaving soon. So Friday is going to come and nobody's going to be in town to do anything.
Yep.
That's absolutely amazing. Again, tomorrow, 4 p.m. to 5:30 p.m. at your local congressional office. the Rally to Save the Postal Service. Again, you can get information at SaveAmericasPostalService.org. We've got a link at TheRickSmithShow.com. Last question I've got for you. You know, some of the Democrats have even thrown out this idea of five-day delivery and some of the consolidation and some of the cuts in services. I'm curious, is this the answer in your opinion, or is it just this House Bill 1351 that will help you move some of that money around?
1351 will really reduce the need to close post offices. I'm not so sure that the Postmaster General didn't do this tactfully, Rick, that he targeted like 3,700 post offices for closure and to what we call AMP, perform area mail processing studies to consolidate a lot of our bigger plants. But he's picked those in many of the congressional districts that, you know, are not necessarily that friendly in order to create a constituency concern in those districts. So hopefully they wake up and realize that we want to save the Postal Service. There's definitely a mechanism for doing it. And, you know, it's a proud institution that's been around for centuries. It shouldn't be left to wither on the vine because of politicos.
But it's amazing to me. The more you delve into the political side of things, once you deal with these CEOs who pit people against one another, it's amazing at how easy it is to fulfill Jay Gould's quote of, I could easily pay half the working class to kill the other half. Just amazing stuff. Anyway, tomorrow, 4 p.m. to 5:30, a rally to save America's Postal Service. Find your local congressional office. If you need more information, SaveAmericasPostalService.org is the website. Mike Gallagher, I appreciate the time, and I guess Monday I'd love to talk to you again to see what happens, if that's possible.
Yeah, we'll make it happen.
All right.
I appreciate all your support, Rick. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Mike. We're going to take a quick break. Right back with your calls. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Not right wing. Just right. The Rick Smith Show.
Wow, someone must have slipped a dose of special Viagra to Barack Obama, for his backbone has suddenly stiffened. Finally showing a bit of real populist fervor, the president drew a line in the sand for plutocratic congressional Republicans. He declared that he would veto any deficit plan that cuts Medicare but lets multimillionaires keep paying a lower tax rate than middle-class families. He called for a minimal tax hike on those making more than $1 million a year, an uptick that would affect fewer than 450,000 privileged Americans who can easily absorb the increase. But oh, the operatic screams of agony from the chorus of Republican harpies in Congress. So jolted were they by the very idea that the rich would be required to share our nation's budgetary burden that they raced to the barricades of wealth, from which they lobbed rhetorical firebombs at Obama. Class war, shrieked the GOP's House Budget Chairman, Representative Paul Ryan. For Ryan to utter that phrase is such gross hypocrisy that I'm amazed he didn't gag on the words, choke, and expire on the spot. This is, after all, the guy who rammed a budget through the House this spring that would have killed Medicare for America's seniors while protecting the multi-billion-dollar subsidies for big oil. How classy is that? Ryan and party have consistently voted for policies that have held down the poor, knocked down middle-class income, and shoved practically all of the wealth created in America during the past decade straight uphill into the pockets of the super-rich. That, Mr. Ryan, is classic class war. This is Jim Hightower saying, Obama nailed the GOP's whine for the poppycock it is, noting that his proposal, quote, is not class warfare, it's math. Yes, and it's something else too, something essential for a democratic society, it's basic fairness.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
Instead of talking about how to safeguard the pensions of Americans who've retired or are about to retire, The Education Workforce Committee is going to conduct yet another witch hunt designed to prove somehow that the National Labor Relations Board is part of some vast Trotskyite conspiracy to kill jobs in the American workforce. The fact of the matter is, what's killing jobs in the American labor market is the inaction, inattention, and ineptitude of the Republican majority.
Boy, I couldn't have said that better myself, Congressman Rob Andrews from New Jersey. And I'll be honest with you, if you don't see it any other way than that, I would love for you to explain it to me, because I am missing the point. When you've got a party who ran on a platform of jobs, 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 but the only things they come out with are division, 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 I don't know what else you could call it. There's no plan there. There's no idea. There's no vision. There's nothing there. There's no there. And you look at what they're doing here in the state of Pennsylvania. I mean, this election scheme, mind-blowing. A mind-blowing diversion from the fact that they don't have a clue. Nothing. There's nothing pinging around in their little brains. Nothing at all. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. If you've got a thought, comment, question, something on your mind. So, Boeing finally finished one of their Dreamliner 787s, and in fact, they had their employees pull the massive structure out to the new customer. Amazing. And all of the workers bowed in unison, because it was a Japanese customer. They all bowed in unison, which is kind of an interesting thing. I would like to see how you got a couple hundred machinists to bow in unison. I don't think a couple hundred truck drivers could do it. I think about the people I worked with over the years, they'd probably fall over. But there is that. But the important thing to me about Boeing, and I think it's great that they're selling planes, and I think it's great that they're producing planes, but this little Bloomberg story caught my eye last week, and I didn't have time to get to it. So this whole thing going on down in South Carolina, the right wing is absolutely incensed that anyone would dare tell the wonderful Boeing Corporation that they can't, that they can't be held accountable for breaking the law. That they should be able to move wherever, whenever, however, doesn't matter. There's nothing, no law, no nothing to restrain them. Nothing. Even if they directly came out and said, well, they screw those workers, we're going to punish them. Evidently, the Republicans don't care about the rule of law. Now we're finding out more and more. Originally it was just this general counsel, Leif Solomon, who came out and said, look, there's enough to move on this. There's enough to investigate it. There's enough to go to administrative law judge. He finds that there's a case. The Republicans went nuts. The GOP presidential candidates all jumped on the bandwagon, all lovers of South Carolina. Oh, how dare you talk about taking jobs out of there? Oh, geez. But the more we find out, the more we look at Project Gemini, as it was called, the more we find that that Boeing, well, they planned this down to the minute. They planned moving those jobs to a labor-friendly state or a business-friendly state like South Carolina. They decided that even if it was going to mean significant risk, because going to South Carolina, they knew, could be a significant risk. In fact, they had to fill in swampland to build on the site that they did. But they did it anyway. And they decided that they were going to build this massive plane with all green employees. None of them know how to turn a screwdriver. Thousands away from where their knowledge base is. I mean, think of the risk that goes into that. That they're going to take, go from coast to coast and take your main project and build it in a place where you have no brain capacity, no knowledge base. Now, the right loves to say, well, they're hiring workers left and right. They've added more than 4,000 jobs since they built that other plant. 4,000 jobs. Here's the problem. Probably as many as 3,000 of those hires will be fired the second that South Carolina plant gets up to producing. Because the South Carolina plant isn't producing anything. They're learning how to produce things. So now you're talking about a process of building from the ground up with a whole a whole knowledge base of empty skulls. So this plane that is going to be the future of your company, you're now basing on moving to somewhere thousands of miles away with no knowledge base in an area, well, good luck. The argument that the machinists have is the president of the company did a slideshow. And you gotta, you know, I tell people, you know, I go back to what my grandfather always said. If you're going to screw something up, don't put your name on it. Never write anything down. Never sign anything. Don't do any of that stuff. They did a little slideshow from the beginning saying, look, we want a place that's going to create a non-union competitive labor choice, lowers labor's costs, and avoids current hostile situation. That's one of the, written in their slides. That's a couple months after a five-month strike. So we're going to go after them. Now, their president, did this thing saying, yeah, it's going to cost us more money, but we're going to get away from the union. And we're going to get away from all of these problems. So I ask you, I go, you know, you look at this, and the reality is the state of Washington was going to give them $3 billion in tax incentives to build that plant there in Washington State. They agreed to that. And then they decided, oh, you know what, we're going to leave anyway. They're executives. Now, this is a matter of fact. Their executives said right in public that the reason they chose South Carolina was to chill any future walkouts. And now we're already seeing people saying, hey, you know, management in Washington saying, hey, you better hurry up. If you don't get that done, we're going to move it to South Carolina. Hey, you better take this, or we're going to move it to South Carolina. So what you're seeing is a destruction of conditions. Again, and you knew this was coming. It was part of the reason they did it. Even if they only move a very small portion to South Carolina, it still means screwed. And it's amazing to me that you have a Republican Party who is so hell-bent on giving them all the control and taking rights away from people, Jake. You know, at the end of this fight is not about Boeing. It's not about South Carolina. It's about workers and their rights. All workers, not just those handful in Seattle or in South Carolina. It's about the nation.
Well, these people, these power brokers, and they are power brokers, they understand that, and it is quite true, the labor movement is the last bastion preventing them from taking over. If they can reduce their political power, how do you do that? You reduce their numbers. How do you reduce numbers? You, wherever possible, deny them the right to organize. Wherever possible, you move jobs to a right-to-work state. You do all that in conjunction with a voter suppression. They believe they have a shot at next year's election. It's, in the end, it's all about raw political power, which equates to them taking complete control of this country. That's exactly what they want.
Yeah, they agree. They admit it. Startup costs in South Carolina are going to cost the company a boatload of money because they had to clear a swamp land to build the factory. I said that before. And they said it would be, quote, significantly greater expense of the increased capacity than it would be in Everett. This is right from their presentation. They knew right up it was going to cost them a boatload of money in South Carolina. Their commercial airlines president, Jim Albar, in this presentation on October 26th of 2009, just days before the plant was to be announced, the one in South Carolina, said that the plant in Charleston would cost $1.5 billion in cash and would reduce earnings on one-third of their 787 backlog. So they're going to spend $1.5 billion. It's going to cost them that much in cash. And it's going to reduce their earnings on a third of the planes they had already sold. And you tell me that's good, smart business decision? That tells me you were evading the law. Plain, simple, easy. It doesn't take a genius to figure this one out. But evidently, our friends on the radical right, they haven't figured that out. And for me, the reality is, if we don't do something, every company, everyone in this country is going to pull stuff like this. Anyway, let's take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around.
Radio of, for, and by We the Working People. The Rick Smith Show.
Ask me, Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? Ask Me Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, Ask Me Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
My name is Precious, and I help people with mental illnesses live better lives. I work for you, the taxpayers, as a mental health case manager. People with mental illnesses can hold jobs, pay taxes, and provide for themselves. But many of them need help from social workers like me to reach their full potential. Imagine if you or someone you love needed that kind of help and had to go on a waiting list for 7 years. That's what 10 years of budget cuts have already done to mental health caseloads in our state. I know these are tough economic times, but without support services, some individuals get worse and can be a danger to themselves and their communities. And that costs all of us much more in the long run. Please contact your state legislators today and demand that they vote to increase funding for programs that help people with mental illnesses lead full lives.
Brought to you by SEIU Local 668. Visit our website at SEIU668.org and join our human services campaign.
Proudly blue in an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
Now we all ought to feel just a little bit guilty when we look into the eyes of our kids. Cause brothers, it's fact, if we take and don't put back, they'll have to pay for all we did. So let's leave some blue up above us. Let's leave some green on the ground. The song we ask to follow.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. So tomorrow in Pittsburgh, the EPA is having a hearing. Again, you know, as the Republicans say,
there is no other agency like the EPA. It should really be renamed the Job Killing Organization of America.
Okay. Yeah, yeah, the Job Killing Organization of America, according to Michelle Bachmann. And really, at the end of the day, you got to wonder if her and her 5 or 23 kids, if they really care about air or water, or I guess it's about profit. But tomorrow they're holding a hearing out there in Pittsburgh about some of the proposed changes and good changes. It's nice to talk about that. But I've asked Carmeline Cherba, she's a citizen activist out in the Pittsburgh area, to come talk to us about the hearing and what she's doing around the issue. Carmeline, thanks for taking time for me.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. You know, the Job Killing Organization of America, that's what Michelle Bachmann calls the EPA. I'm sorry, I don't see it that way. As a kid, I suffered from asthma. I'm thankful.
It's more like, would they rather kill people? They want to have an unhealthy community? If we're going to talk about killing jobs with regulations. I
mean, well, as long as they can put that pollution in the poor areas, put that pollution in someone else's backyard, I'm sure they don't really care.
Right. I'm sure the CEO of Halliburton doesn't live here in Williamsport.
So let's talk about this.
Shall play.
Let's talk about this. As a mother, you moved from Philadelphia to get away from the pollution, the bad air. You go up into an area that you think, hey, it's going to have open space, going to have clean air. And what do you encounter?
We got here about 3 years ago, and about a year ago I found out that we're on top of the Marcellus Shale, which is one of the biggest shale plays in the United States right now. And with that shale play comes a lot of air pollution. And we live in a valley where there is an inversion factor, and a lot of that air stays right in our valley.
Right.
And the emissions that are emitted from compressor sites and from the gas fields contributes to the emissions in our area.
So you've got all this industrialization, all of this pollution from the machines, not to mention something from the holes that we're punching in the ground.
Right. So we already have poor air quality in our area with their sorry, I've never done an interview
before. No, that's
before,
okay.
So I'm a little nervous.
We're just talking on the phone here. I mean, you know, how are your kids handling this? I mean, I remember as a kid growing up in Cleveland, the news at night used to have air quality index reporting to where tomorrow, if the pollution was bad, kids like me who suffered from asthma had to stay in the house. So I'm sympathetic to kids who have asthma. I hope your kids like me are able to outgrow it. But how are they handling this?
They're doing okay. Their asthma has gotten a little worse since we moved here. I'm keeping an eye on it, and if it does seem to get even worse than it already is, then we're probably going to have to move out of the area. But what I'm doing right now is I'm trying to change the zoning in my area so that they will restrict compressor stations and oil and gas activity in an urban residential area.
So you don't want it in the middle of, college campuses like Governor Corbett said we should be doing, or on elementary school property, because, hey, that's where the money is, since we're slashing and burning public education.
Right, and right now the setbacks that they're proposing in the Loyal Fuck Township zoning ordinance is only 1,000 feet from schools, churches, hospitals, playgrounds, sports facilities.
A thousand feet. Now, is it possible that they'll be drilling under the places where they'll be? I mean, you put the injection site in 1,000 feet away. I know it goes down a couple thousand feet and then over. You could be drilling right under the school, I think, right?
They could possibly. It just depends on where they are. I mean, we happen to have the Williams Transco pipeline running through our township.
Well, lucky you.
Yeah. So there will be a lot of compressor stations. And as those compressor stations grow, they create ground-level ozone that will regularly be held in place by the air inversion factor we see in the valley here.
Right, because you're in a valley. Wow, that's horrible.
Right. In February 2006, a policy was rescinded by the Corbett administration. The new policy advises air quality permitting staff to look only at individual pollution emitting sites rather than the cumulative impacts the gas industry will have on Pennsylvania's air quality. So instead of looking at them aggregated,
you're looking at them individually and not being able to.
Look at them individually.
Yeah, you're not looking at the entire picture. Again, you know, very smart policy if you're the industry, not very good policy if you're a resident.
No, but the VOCs are becoming a major issue in Texas, Colorado, and Wyoming, and that's why the EPA is having these hearings. They're having a hearing tomorrow in Pittsburgh. They're having one in Arlington and one in Colorado.
Now, will you be at the one in Pittsburgh?
I will not. I have two sets of twins, and so I can't get away. Our Loyal Fuck Township meeting is tomorrow, too, so I couldn't go. But I did submit a comment. And we've tried to get as many people as possible to go. I mean, that's the problem. I mean, there's so many things going on, and nobody knows what to do, or they don't want to get off their couch. Nobody wants to do anything. We're not going to change this unless people write a comment or say something.
And the reality is there's so much disinformation out there. You don't know what's true and what's not. I just heard Rand Paul the other day come out and say, well, you know, all that methane that's catching people's water on fire, well, that's from 400 feet. Well, they're drilling down to 4,000 feet. And, you know, the first thing I thought of, Rand, buddy, don't you know you have to go to 400 feet before you can get to 4,000? I mean, just, again, you know, this whole play, all this theatrics to divert us away from what's actually happening.
Right. I mean, the Responsible Drilling Alliance does a lot of good work. So does Earth Justice. You can go on the Earth Justice website, earthjustice.org/fracking, and they have a lot of information on their details, especially about these hearings.
So let me ask you this, Carmeline. What do you say to the people who say, well, we need the jobs. This is a boon. We're going to make, you know, millions and millions of dollars. Going to put all these people back to work. We just have to, you know, pollute a little bit of our environment.
Well, for one thing, the jobs aren't going to be here forever. Some of these kids that are foregoing going to college so they can get a CDL license in 10, 15 years, they're not going to have that job anymore, and they're going to have a mortgage, and they're going to have children. And those driving jobs aren't going to be available anymore.
And we're going to be left with
we're going to have a toxic wasteland here, and they are exempt from the Superfund Act. So taxpayers of Pennsylvania are going to pay to remediate all of that damage. Not to mention that it's not a lot of money coming in. I mean, it's a lot of out-of-state people that are here, and a lot of the good jobs go to out-of-state people. And Texas and Wyoming and Colorado and all these other states had the same boom, and they also have a very high unemployment rate.
Yeah, and they also have something that we don't, which is a drilling tax.
Correct. There are some good bills out there. There's one bill in particular that's not a good bill, and that's one that Gene Yaw has sponsored. And if he wants the Public Utility Commission to set the zoning for the entire state, and any of the municipalities and townships that don't go along with that zoning will not get any of the money from the severance tax.
No, I'll have to look into that. You know, in your opinion, is there a safe way of doing this? Is there a way that you could see this happening, the drilling in a safe manner that's not going to harm the environment? I guess any worse than coal would be or drilling for oil in Texas or the Middle East?
I think there are a lot of things that they could do. They could switch it over to a closed-loop system so that you don't have this wastewater in open pits. It's in a tank. They reuse a lot of that water. There are actually a lot of things that they do. With the compressor stations, they can capture the emissions coming from the compressor stations and use that to run the compressor stations. Compressor engines, you know, they release about 60 tons of nitrogen oxide per year per compressor station.
So you're not against drilling per se. It's just the way it's being done.
I mean, I just don't think we're going to stop it. Of course, I would like for it to end, but I don't think that it's going to end. But I think there's a lot of things that they can do to make it a lot safer. You know, there's common sense things that shouldn't happen, like putting it near schools or near people's residence.
That's where I'm with you. It's easy to say I'm against it and I'm going to slam my fist down, but at the end of the day, you're not going to stop it. So what you need to do is you need to figure out how you can live with it and harm the fewest number of people in the process.
Pretty much. I mean, they should also disclose what's in those fracking fluids. There aren't enough EPA people to really regulate them. They're left to regulate themselves. That's basically what another problem is with it.
Well, that's what happens when you starve government.
I mean, with the pipelines and all the things that are going in, I mean, you should see some of these pipelines that go in. They're on such a steep slope. I mean, these are unregulated. I don't know who's going to come back and make sure that these are okay in 50 years.
And that's part of the problem. I look at the coal industry, what they got away with for years and years, and I worry about that's our future again because we haven't learned that lesson. Let me ask you this, Carmeline. If someone wanted to get involved, because there are a lot of people, like you said, who are sitting out there, they don't know what to do, and maybe they want to take action. Maybe they want to testify, or maybe they want to be involved in somehow. What advice would you give them?
I would ask them if they have any grassroots organizations in their own community. If they don't, the Responsible Drilling Alliance, they have a website, responsibledrillingalliance.org. We post a lot of things on our website. So does Earth Justice. Penn Futures puts a lot of stuff out there. I mean, the best thing you could do is just call your congresspeople. Show up to some of these town hall meetings where your state representatives are and talk to them about the issues that you have with this. Try to get your zoning changed. When your township is going to propose a new zoning ordinance, go to the township meetings.
Or if you happen to be in Pittsburgh tomorrow, go and at the Lawrence Convention Center and testify about it. Also, you can send in some other comments. There is a comment period. I think until October.
Yes.
I think the 24th is what I have here in front of me. All you have to do is go to the EPA's website and contact Joan Rogers. Is the name that we have, rogers.jonesc@epa.gov. We'll put it up on our website.
Yeah, they also have a link to the regulatory actions for oil and natural gas air pollution standards, and that's epa.gov/air quality/oil and gas.
That's what we'll put on the website as well. Again, I mean, this is one of those things that's not going away anytime soon, so we've got to stay on top of it.
No, and this is going to be huge for the elections coming up. I mean, everybody's talking about lax regulations and drilling and natural resources and why aren't we doing this in America, but a lot of this natural gas is going to go overseas. This isn't just staying in the United States.
Which just blows my mind. It's been sold to us as the transition fuel off of oil, but we're going to sell it to the Chinese.
Right, and all of the numbers that the Marcellus Shell Coalition has put out there as far as taxes that have been paid and they skew these numbers. That's not reality. You can look on the labor on the labor website for the labor industry government website, and it has the numbers on there. They don't pay as much as they're saying that they're paying. A lot of these companies are set up as an LLC, and they're paying 3% tax.
Yeah, well, we're the ones getting screwed over because we're the ones who have the people who took the pledge. The grand pledge. Carmeline, I appreciate the time.
Okay.
I appreciate your activism. Keep up the fight.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks so much. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Class majority. Rick Smith.
Hi, I'm Bob Snyder, president of Teamsters Local 776 here in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. For more than 100 years, Teamsters have been standing together to create a better tomorrow. We Teamster members are your friends and neighbors. Teamsters move goods across the nation, take care of seniors, serve and protect our community, and so much more. We are hardworking, dedicated professional workers, united to make our lives, our communities, and our nation stronger. If you want to be part of the team, join the Teamsters for a better tomorrow. Contact us at 1-800-692-6280. That's 1-800-692-6280. Or visit our website at TeamstersLocal776.org. We are people helping people.
That old washer or dryer on the fritz, and you don't have a bucks for a new one? Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211. You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well. Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211. How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
Fuzzy math. It's fuzzy math. Fuzzy math. I'm practicing fuzzy math. For a long time, I've been needing to fudge the numbers and not tell the truth. For diplomacy to be effective, lies must be credible.
Oh, I love that. Lies. I love George Bush. In fact, he's in town tonight. In Hershey, doing the whole Chamber of Commerce love fest. After all, they are paying this salary. I guess you make $100,000 coming in, talking about how things, wonderful things were during the Bush years. A little revisionist math. I don't know if you saw over the weekend, the Herman Cain train steamed right past Romney, right past Perry. Yeah, I guess he did it, and maybe he'll do it again, just like the song. So great going, Florida. You set the stage for the other 49 states. According to an email I got today, and you got to love this, and I love these. I love being on these conservative email lists because, you know, the crazy people send me all of this great, all this great, insane email. They tip the hat to Governor Rick Scott for having the correctness and guts to move forward on this critical issue. The email is, hooray for Florida. They say that I-95 will be jammed for the next month or so, druggies and deadbeats heading north out of Florida. You see, Florida is the first state requiring drug testing to receive welfare. Hooray for Florida, the email says. In signing the new law, Republican Governor Rick Scott said, if Floridians want welfare, they better make sure they're drug-free. Applicants who test positive for illicit substances, the email says, won't be eligible for the funds for a year or until they undergo treatment. Those who fail a second time will be banned from receiving funds for 3 years. The email says, naturally, a few people are crying, this is unconstitutional. Well, how is this unconstitutional, it asks. It's completely legal that every other working person have to pass a drug test in order to get a job which supports those on welfare. And I'm going, well, don't you have a problem with having to take a drug test to begin with? I mean, wouldn't that be the point of this whole thing? Evidently not for these people who keep sending this email around. And I've gotten this a couple of times, and only now I decided to, you know, maybe bring it up. Because what's going on is Florida is now being sued by a bunch of people. I think there are like 10 or 12 suits on this that are going to cost the state of Florida a boatload of money. A boatload of money. And here's the thing. Some results are already in. The drug testing started in July. And you know how many of those drug-addicted welfare recipients we've caught? 2%. A whopping 2%. 96% of the people proved drug-free. 2% were inconclusive, so we're going to have to test those again, meaning more cost. So understand, the average test costs about $30. 2% they caught. 2%! Now, what I find amazing is you look at the National Survey on Drug Use and Health from 2009. It was performed by the U.S. Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services. They say that people over 12, 8.7% of the population over 12 nationally uses illicit drugs. For people 26 and up, the rate was 6.3. Evidently, welfare people don't use drugs. I guess if you're going to buy the stereotype, because this drug testing program is based on the stereotype. It's not based on fact. And you could have, if you would have asked me, I would have told you, I'm sorry, they don't have the money for drugs. On $3 a day, you can't buy much crack. Pretty simple. It's the people who are breaking in your house, stealing your television. Those are generally the people who are the drug addicts. The vast majority of people who are on welfare, those are people who are trying to feed their kids. Those are people who, you know, need the help. But, you know, you just can't let a good frame go, Jake. You just can't let it go. Got to have the good frame. Just like the other one. Have you ever heard the Obama uses a teleprompter? You ever heard the Republicans go nuts about that?
Yes.
He actually had a Republican congressman who wanted to cut funding for the teleprompter. You know, this shows you how little they understand about government. They wanted to, if you remember the NLRB thing we talked about earlier, they wanted to defund one case that the NLRB was handling. Just one case, the Boeing case. We wanted to fund that. And then they realized, well, duh, we can't do that. So let's just screw it. We'll defund the whole thing. So this teleprompter thing is kind of funny. Because Rick Scott, you know, thought he would, you know, hey, I'm going to poke fun at the president too. And he said, you know, he got up behind the microphone and said, I have to admit it, I was a little nervous when I looked out here and I saw all the cameras, all the TV cameras, and a teleprompter. I figured President Obama must be here giving another one of those speeches about raising taxes that he read from a teleprompter. Am I the only one who sees the irony in trying to jab somebody over using a teleprompter while yourself using the teleprompter? The hypocrisy, just mind-blowing. So I have been calling it for a while, Jake, and you told me no. I think everybody's been telling me no. Christie's not going to jump in. Latest reports, Christie's jumping in. Within a couple of days, they claim he's going to enter the race. Why? Because the big money people, the big bucks, the billionaire class, they're looking at Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs and going, unwinnable, 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 loser, loser, loser. And they've said, we better go find somebody else.
Well, here's the problem. Two problems, actually, I see. First of all, I didn't hear that, Rick. Did you get that on? Earlier today, they had talked about it almost the whole day, but they said, as of now, he's still a little
reticent. As of now.
Here's the problems I see. I mean, he was adamant. He went on, 60 Minutes, and he made a big deal about it, and he was a big hit of making jokes about how many times and how many ways and what does he have to do to make sure that people understand he's not running. The problem is that the right thing to do long-term politically?
Yes.
Is it?
Absolutely.
Is it?
If the deep funders are saying we will supply you with the means necessary because none of the other losers on the stage have a chance, you take that chance and run with it. Because understand, none of those people right now do I see them beating Obama. I see Christie having that ability to get that middle-of-the-road white working-class voter to really get behind him.
I think the right is it a tizzy, if that's the right word. I actually think they're really a little bit afraid because they saw Perry basically almost disintegrate.
Oh, he's imploding.
I mean, that was horrible.
Every time the guy opens his mouth.
But it was worse. I mean, there were just simple things that anyone involved in politics would have known or could have finessed it, and he just absolutely got it wrong.
Yeah, I mean, his campaign is just falling apart. I thought he was going to be much better, much more Bushian. He's even dumber than Bush, which I didn't think was possible. Sorry if you're listening to this, George, but, I didn't. The reality is that the Republican field right now, there's nobody who can win. And the moneyed interests, from the reports that I've seen, have been spending a lot of time courting Christie, who, again, I think he's automatically the front runner. I mean, look, Michelle Bachmann, really? Do you really think she's got a chance? Someone who thinks that if we have some kind of trade with Cuba, that they're going to agree to let Hezbollah put missile silos in Cuba to attack us? Really, Hezbollah? What she actually said, and I'm going, really, you're actually saying this? She goes, yes. There's a report that has come out that Cuba has been working with another terrorist organization called Hezbollah, she says. And Hezbollah is looking at wanting to be part of missile sites in Iran. And, of course, when you're 90 miles offshore of Florida, you don't want to entertain the prospect of hosting bases or sites where Hezbollah could have training camps or perhaps missile sites or weapon sites in Cuba. Oh, my God, we're afraid of Cuba now? We're afraid of some little island where somebody's going to put a little rocket launcher? How nuts is this woman?
Well, if I can just for the moment get back to Governor of New Jersey, it's one thing. I think that a lot of Republicans like him because he's loud, he's aggressive, he's angry, and he defends his position. Now, it's one thing. First of all, I don't know if you know this, Rick, but his approval ratings have sank like a rock within his state. That's the first point. But the second point is, I think he appeals to the right-wing conservatives because they see him as a warrior who will be out there and get in your face. That doesn't necessarily mean that what he stands for is going to be accepted by the American people. I'm not sure. Yeah, he's been governor now for a year and a half. I'm not sure he's ready for the big time.
I think the second,
well, we shall see.
The second he puts his name in, it doesn't matter to the right. What matters that he's going to be that decisive candidate, that person who, you know, who's not going to waffle, who's not going to put up with guff. I think he's the...
Well, they also went into that a little bit, and
he's the guy.
On certain litmus test, Rick, he might not pass the extreme right's litmus test.
Well,
he was, I think, the only governor, if you remember, the business people were putting up ads, anybody unemployed need not apply. Well, I believe he got legislation passed that said you can't do that anymore. Now, for the purist out there on the right, that's an imposition into the right of the employer, and they don't like that. So that's only one. I'm sure if you look at other positions, he might not be 100%er. So
well, there's
maybe
none
the,
of them. There
the,
none of
well,
them.
But for the right wingers
right
who control the party.
This.
Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. In New York City, Iron Workers Metallic Lathers Local 46 is using the federal racketeering law known as RICO to sue developers for allegedly conspiring to cheat union construction workers. Doug Cunningham reports.
The union's lawsuit accuses La Lazarian Developers, JMH Development, and the principals of HRH Construction with an illegal conspiracy to bilk union construction workers out of millions of dollars of wages and benefits. Local 46 business manager Bob Ledwith says the violation of the collective bargaining agreements here hurt both union workers and society in general.
Society itself and the taxpayer picks up all the expenses of these people, both currently and in the future, and we are deprived of the work, so we don't pay taxes. Many times they're working off the books. So this thing spirals down worse and worse, both for the American taxpayer and for the union member.
The Local 46 RICO suit against these developers alleges that the developers knowingly violated collective bargaining agreements to illegally perform millions of dollars of construction work under the guise of a phony, non-union alter ego firm called Leviathan Construction Management. It cost union workers $7 million. If found guilty, the developers will have to pay more than $21 million.
I'm just hoping that this example resonates and others decide to say, let's see if our collective bargaining agreements have been violated and let us go forward in the example of Local 46.
It's negotiation time at Atlantic City's casinos. Workers represented by Unite Here are at the bargaining table with Caesars, Harrah's, Bally's, Showboat, and Trump Casinos. Last week was the first full week operating without a contract. The casinos are looking for substantial cuts from employees, roughly $3 per hour. They also want employees to cover some of the cost of health and pension benefits. That's a lot to ask of a workforce that has the average wage of $12 per hour. The union has counteroffered with a pay cut of 50 cents. That proposal is the first time in the negotiating history with these unions that Unite has put a concessions offer on the bargaining table. On Friday, the workers received support in the form of Teamsters President James P. Hoffa. Hoffa said in a statement that the Teamsters support Unite Here's mission to stop casinos from turning the gaming industry into an industry of poverty-level jobs. In 2004, negotiations resulted in a strike that lasted 34 days. The unions have acknowledged that striking this year would be more costly due to the ongoing economic climate.
Pacifica Radio says it's riveting. This is what democracy looks like. Wisconsin's Worker Uprising is a one-hour documentary from Madison-based Workers Independent News. Get your copy today at laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. So Atlanta Christian College, changing their name and relocating. Atlanta Christian College will now be known as Point University. The all-new and improved Point University will hold its first semester of classes in West Point, Georgia. So it can be close to the Kia plant. Evidently, Kia University, as it's being dubbed, thought long and hard about where they could find their base. So they are located next to the Kia plant. And I think we should be making all of education much more business friendly. I mean, get rid of all of that subtle stuff. Education is about feeding corporations, trained workers who learn how to push the buttons but never ask why. At least that seems to be the push that's going on. And this past Saturday, the Delaware Valley Americans United chapter held a debate on SB1, the voucher bill. And the usual pro-privatization of public education players were there. You had Hardy Williams, senator from the Philly area there, who's the co-sponsor of the attack bill, the voucher SB1 bill, and Leslie Davis Heiner, the VP at the Foundation for Educational Choice. I love that, the Foundation for Educational Choice. She's someone who the Wall Street Journal called the nation's leading voucher advocate. Well paid people. And on the other side, the pro-public education side, our good friend Mark Steer. Mark, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, I'm happy to be here to talk about it, Rick.
So I can't imagine. You had a state senator, a very well-paid state senator, and this woman from the Foundation for Educational Choice, the nation's leader in voucher
advocacy. It's the Milton Friedman Foundation now.
Oh, is that what it is?
Yeah, it's the Milton Friedman Foundation. And I, I know where most of the money is coming from for a lot of these groups. They're, our friends, the Scapes, the DeVos family, the Amway family, the Waltons. I don't know whether they fund her organization, but let's just put it this way. They have a really, really nice website and, really nice glossy materials that they hand out. So, someone's paying them, giving them a lot of money, and
I would say that
the usual suspects.
Yeah, I would say that the reason they're giving them a lot of money is not because they just believe so deeply in education. It's that they're going to figure out a way to profit off of this in the future.
Well, that's basically what it is. I think two things are going on. One is about 8 years ago, William Bennett, the former Secretary of Education, the guy who wrote the book about virtue before he lost. Well, yeah, he lost a ton of money gambling. Evidently, that wasn't one of the virtues, not gambling. He said, this is an issue that can split Democrats because it will appeal to people who represent particularly low-income folks in the black community and who are concerned about the fact that schools in those communities are not what they should be. And, I'm the first one to say, yeah, they're not what they should be. And so there's a political strategy, and I can come back to that in a minute, but the other strategy is, they know that if you can start undermining the public schools, you start reducing the public sector, you drive down wages in the public sector, and that drives down wages in the private sector, and that helps the businesses make more money. You shrink the public sector, you reduce taxes on the rich, that also helps the business people and the rich make more money. And you undermine public sector unions, which diminishes the power of progressives.
On the micro level,
I'd
agree.
That's really what it comes down to.
On the micro level, I would absolutely agree, and that's the mentality. But on the macro level, once you look at an entire society based on low wages, how does that help the wealth class? I mean, there are no consumers to consume their products then.
I've been thinking a lot about that. And the conclusion I'm coming to?
What's that? They don't care.
The big corporations in America and the rich people who own them have absolutely no common interest with most Americans anymore. If they can't sell here, they'll sell in China, or they'll sell in Germany. Wherever the economy is good, they'll sell there. They'll produce somewhere else. They don't have to produce in America. The big corporations basically have totally separated themselves from the American people. There's no such thing as a big corporation that's American anymore. Their interest is totally on their own, and they don't have to sell to us. They'll sell to someone else. I think that's basically what it comes down to. They look at that big Chinese market and they figure they may not have a lot of money there, but there sure are a lot of them.
Yeah, there sure are a lot of them, but the problem is that the Chinese aren't letting us in, much to their you got to give them credit. They're the ones who are deciding, hey, we're gonna ship everything out. We're gonna make sure we guard our market from the things that we're doing to everybody else.
Yeah, but what our big companies are doing, they're making deals with the Chinese, and the Chinese say, we'll let you produce here, but you got to export the technology.
Yeah, well, that's the scary
thing. And so they're taking technology invented by Americans, paid for by American tax dollars, which fund the universities and the researchers that develop that technology. That technology is being exported by so-called R corporations to China.
Yeah, did you see the story about GM and that SAIC corporation over there in China? They're gonna have a joint venture on an electric car, and they claim they're not going to take the Volt technology. Nonsense.
Yeah, of course they're going
to
take that.
So let's go back to something you said a second ago. You said that the schools in some of the poorer districts aren't what they should be. What should they be? Because to me, I go, privatization is not the answer. How do we fix the schools that are having trouble and really save the ones that are doing all right?
Well, the first thing that I talked about on Saturday was, look, schools in this country basically are okay. We have 30 years of reports saying, in terms of an international comparison, our schools aren't good. But the fact is, we educate a lot more people in academic high schools than anywhere else in the world, and we're a lot more unequal and have a lot more poverty than anywhere else in the world. You look at the top 80% in terms of family income, schools that teach those kids, our students do as well as students anywhere in the world. You look at the bottom 15%, our schools don't do a good job. And the reason is it has nothing to do with the schools. It basically is the result of the fact that our society is far more unequal and poverty is far deeper and far more concentrated in the United States than anywhere else in the developed world.
See, that's the position I've taken. Look, you can have the greatest facilities in the world and you can have the best teachers in the world. If the kids aren't coming to school prepared to learn, if they don't have the push from home, if they don't have the home environment, it doesn't matter. I don't think it matters all that much. I mean, in some cases, but not for the most part. You know, I grew up in it. I remember.
Yeah, the fact is, you got to have models of success, of education leading to success. And even Senator Williams said, as we broke down some of the racial barriers, the black middle class has moved away from black poor folks, and they've left communities behind, and these are his words, not mine, that are a shell of what they once were. And those communities are tend to be violent, tend to be people, a lot of people are hopeless, long-term unemployed, and that undermines education in those communities. Senator Williams is always talking about violence in the public schools. The fact is the public schools are some of the safer places.
In those neighborhoods, absolutely.
In those neighborhoods.
But at the end of this, Mark, don't you think a thriving economy, an economy that is creating jobs and pulling people up, isn't that the answer more than saying, hey, let's trash the public school system and find out how much we can squeeze out of it?
Yeah, I said at the end I was very frustrated by the debate because here we are. Senator Williams has supported a lot of good things. I mean, in some ways, I think he's still basically a progressive, although he quoted some people that disappointed me, Steve Brill, for example. But, here we are arguing amongst ourselves, and what are we not talking about? We're not talking about creating public works jobs for people. We're not talking about investing in our cities, investing in commercial districts. We're not talking about more money from the federal government for states and local governments to keep the teachers that we're cutting this year and to keep other public sector workers, which tend to be a higher percentage of working people in poor neighborhoods. It's basically a big distraction from all the things that would really make a difference. And, the other thing I point out, President Obama just proposed putting a lot of money into rebuilding schools. I think in Philadelphia we get $365 million is what I've heard from that. The folks who are supporting vouchers are the people who are opposing that in Washington. The folks who are supporting vouchers are the people who opposed the federal stimulus, which kept our state and local schools operating. They oppose everything that might actually help the public schools and that might actually help the economy, particularly in poor urban neighborhoods. And now they say they're big proponents of helping poor kids get out of bad schools. Senator Williams may believe this in his heart, but as I told him the other day, he's playing on the wrong team.
Yeah, I agree.
Because they do not have the interest of working people, poor people, of middle class people in their hearts.
You know, I look at, and I've had conversations about Senator Williams' position because, you know, on one hand, like you pointed out earlier, I can see that, you know, he just wants to give his constituents this opportunity that may or may not be there. But then the other side of this is, maybe I'm wrong on this. Isn't he part of a charter school with his father's name on it? And isn't there some family ties into this, all this whole thing?
Yeah, I think he does have a charter school, you know. I think that there's, you know, look, we know that there's political influence in charter schools, and there's likely to be political influence in schools that are, in which kids can go because of vouchers. That might have something to do with it. I'm not ready to say that Senator Williams isn't sincere about this. He talked very powerfully about kids in his district and parents come and say, what should I do with these kids? You know, they want to learn, they can. And look, it's hard not to be sympathetic to that.
Right.
On the other hand, you know, there's study after study that shows that vouchers make no difference. They don't improve education. You know, if I saw that evidence that said, yeah, you take 5% of the kids, and this legislation will not give vouchers to more than about 5% of the kids who don't currently go to the schools, private schools. Most of the money will go to kids who already go to private schools, and mostly they go to parochial schools. But even if we're only 5%, if it really made a difference, if that could change the lives of 5% of the kids in poor neighborhoods, you know, I'd be a lot more sympathetic to it.
Right.
So we've got no evidence of that.
Now, here's the thing that bothers me. I keep seeing all of this money telling me why my public school is no good. I keep seeing, advertisement for PA Cyber Charter, which is the public cyber charter school. And I see K-12.org, and I see all this money being poured into a gubernatorial candidate that doesn't stand a snowball's chance. And I see all this money coming from the DeVos people and the Scapes and all this money that's telling me why we need vouchers and all of this political pressure to pass and privatize and profitize public education. I say, well, if we've got all this money to do that, why don't we have that money to fix what's wrong with our public schools?
they put all the money they put into political advocacy and you know, giving scholarships to kids, they could probably really help the 5% of the kids that SB1 is going to help anyway, and then save us $1 billion in tax dollars. Most of it will go to kids who are already in private schools.
Now, I mean, it's amazing to me that we're talking about creating a billion-dollar handout program for people who are already in private schools, as you pointed out, at a time when we've already cut almost $1 billion to education. What does this mean for my kids going to a middle-class school? Because, you know, I don't know if you've seen the reports, but, you know, some of the reports that I've been reading lately, the very high-end schools, like some of the wealthier areas, $20,000, $22,000 per student. Some of the very poor areas get federal subsidies, so they're okay a little bit. It's the middle-class schools, the schools like in neighborhoods like I live in and other working-class people live in, that the funding's falling. So yeah. That middle-class student is struggling now. And to me, this is all by design to just tank the whole system.
Yeah, I've said that many times that the part of the goal here is to create a political dynamic where you take money away from the public schools, they get worse, there's more pressure to privatize, you do more privatization, you take more money from the public schools, they get worse again. I mean, these people are not fools. They understand politics. They understand how you change public policy, you can create pressure to further undermine the public sector. And that's fundamentally their goal.
Last question I've got.
You could make an argument for vouchers, actually, as an egalitarian proposal, but it wouldn't look anything like this, and it wouldn't exclude teachers' unions, because we know that wherever there are teachers' unions, education is better in this country.
Yep.
You know, and it would do something about the incredible disparity in funding between Lower Merion and Philadelphia. Vouchers could actually do something if you really wanted to develop in a progressive way. And the first time Pennsylvanians opposed to vouchers met, and I was on the phone, and they went around the table and went around the phone, and people on the phone said, hey, are you opposed to the SB1? And I would say half the people there said, well, I'm really opposed to SB1. It's a terrible piece of legislation. But, you know, the idea of vouchers isn't that terrible if you do it the right way. But this is, you know, and I don't, you know, I'm not saying I'm in favor of them. I'm just saying if they were serious about choice, if choice were the issue, the proposal would look really different.
Yeah, and this
doesn't give choice to parents. This gives choice to schools who don't have to take any kids they don't want to and don't have to accept the tuition that's in the voucher and can deny people on the basis of religion or ability or disability entrance. It doesn't give choice to parents. And so it's, you know, it's really a phony proposal.
What was your feeling, last question, what was your feeling of the people in the room? Do you think this is gonna go through? I mean, is there really a clamoring for it other than on the political class?
Certainly the folks in the room were overwhelmingly opposed to vouchers. I think there are a couple people who took Senator Williams' side, but most of them were pretty much on our side. And, you know, a lot of them were moved. I was speaking with Bert Kane, who's a Temple University law professor, and he's focused on the issues of freedom of religion. And, you know, when you hear what's taught in some of these private schools, the religious schools, some of the, you know, some of the intolerant ideas expressed there, it's another reason to be worried. And I think that moved a lot of people, as well as the more economic arguments I was talking about.
Well, like I said, when they pass it, I'm starting a Muslim charter school right in center county.
Yeah, right. Well, you know, I think they're going to have a hard time, because the problem is the more the narrower they draw the bill, so that it really does provide more aid to low income kids, the less support it has around the state. And then on the other hand, if they broaden the bill, then it becomes enormously expensive.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest.
So you lose that support anyway. I just don't see politically how they do this, except unless Governor Corbett decides, you know, he owes too much to the really wealthy people who've supported him. He owes too much to the education entrepreneurs who have given him campaign contributions, and he just finds a way to push it through.
Well, we will see how this plays out. Mark Steer, always great talking with you. I appreciate it, and thanks so much.
Thank you for having me. Good to talk to you again.
All righty. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Right back after this.
This is why we fight, why we
for the rest of us, Rick Smith.
Wow, someone must have slipped a dose of special Viagra to Barack Obama, for his backbone has suddenly stiffened. Finally showing a bit of real populist fervor, the president drew a line in the sand for plutocratic congressional Republicans. He declared that he would veto any deficit plan that cuts Medicare but lets multimillionaires keep paying a lower tax rate than middle-class families. He called for a minimal tax hike on those making more than $1 million a year, an uptick that would affect fewer than 450,000 privileged Americans who can easily absorb the increase. But oh, the operatic screams of agony from the chorus of Republican harpies in Congress. So jolted were they by the very idea that the rich would be required to share our nation's budgetary burden that they raced to the barricades of wealth, from which they lobbed rhetorical firebombs at Obama. Class war, shrieked the GOP's House Budget Chairman, Representative Paul Ryan. For Ryan to utter that phrase is such gross hypocrisy that I'm amazed he didn't gag on the words, choke, and expire on the spot. This is, after all, the guy who rammed a budget through the House this spring that would have killed Medicare for America's seniors while protecting the multi-billion dollar subsidies for big oil. How classy is that? Ryan and party have consistently voted for policies that have held down the poor, knocked down middle-class income, and shoved practically all of the wealth created in America during the past decade straight uphill into the pockets of the super-rich. That, Mr. Ryan, is classic class war. This is Jim Hightower saying, Obama nailed the GOP's whine for the poppycock it is, noting that his proposal, quote, is not class warfare, it's math. Yes, and it's something else too, something essential for a democratic society, it's basic fairness.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
Just when you thought it was safe, those crazy Republicans are at it again. It's time for the Rick Smith Show's Conservative Alert.
Well, it looks like Todd Platts, according to the 9/12 Patriots, evidently Todd Platts is a useful idiot. And I love this. You know, I was reading this story in the Patriot on Sunday. And I don't know if you saw this, but I'm not a huge Todd Platts fan. He's very snake-like. But, you know, he goes to this 9/12 meeting. The New York 9/12 Patriots. So they have their little meeting where they show this movie, The Agenda Grinding America Down, which, according to the paper, asserts that a communist and socialist agenda is eroding American cultural values. So during the presentation, you know, they invited Platts to come along. Be part of their group. And so somebody stands up and starts, you know, alleging that he's a communist and a socialist and, you know, that he's the useful idiot. And I kind of laugh at this. And then they say, well, we weren't calling him names. I guess that's how 9/12 people show their affection, by calling people useful idiots and doing the things that they were doing. Kind of makes me laugh. Platts is going to have some problems, I think, with the T-Twits because he's not insane enough. He's out there, but not that far. And I look at these people, and to be honest, you know, the more I look at these folks, they sit in their little world. They watch their little movies. They're very much like the Alex Jones followers. They've got their conspiratorial ideas that everyone's out to get them. And I got to be honest, I'd hate to live in that world where everything is a conspiracy and the commies are out to get you. And I'm going, you know, the commies? Really? We're still talking about that. But here they are. You know, they've got their little group and they're watching their little movies and they've got their own little language. And I think what's going on right now, and Platts waking up to the reality that these people are not his friends anymore. I think the Republicans had better wake up to the reality that the thing that put them into power is now out of the bottle. And there is almost no way of getting these crazy people back into the bottle. You have pushed them and given them enough rope that they're going to hang you. And it's going to be interesting to see. I think Platts will get a primary challenge. I think the Tea Party will run somebody against him. I know Boehner's got a Tea Party challenger. I saw him on TV, not much of a challenge there, but still, someone's going to seek it. And, you know, who knows? But I find that funny. Jake, you're a communist and a socialist, and you're no good. You're a useful idiot, but I'm not calling you names.
Well, I like the fact that they're going to have to spend money defending themselves in the primary. I think that's pretty laughable. I think that's a definite plus for the Democrats. I mean, from time to time in history, you have groups like this sprouting up. Unfortunately for America, I think they were the recipient of what was really, for the Republicans, a perfect storm in 2010. You had a lot of people staying away. You had that great middle that pretty much swung to the Republican Party, and then you had just an avalanche of money coming in and supporting Republican Party. But little did they know that when the Republicans took control, I don't know, it's kind of like bringing along a disease with you and not knowing it's there. And
that's a good one. The Tea Party, absolutely.
That's a
boil on the backside, yep, of society.
And they were fermenting their little revolutions, and now they brought some of those revolutions to fruition. And I find it kind of amusing to watch the Republicans twist and squirm. Boehner, I mean, I shouldn't even say poor guy because he deserves everything he gets. But in a sense, you had to feel sorry for him because no matter what he did, it wasn't good enough. And then he had to go back and kiss the ring and get their opinion and then come out and tell that to the public. And he had to know that some of those positions were going to hurt him politically, going to hurt the Republican Party politically, and it absolutely will. I'm convinced of that.
Well, we'll see. That's why we play the game. Here's one of those I got to ask my T-Twizzlers where you stand on this. Are you with the Constitution or are you with Jesus? Constitution or Jesus? Evidently in Bay Minette, Alabama, the little town of Bay Minette, they have this brand new program, alternative sentencing program for very first-time offenders, nonviolent people who get the choice. You can either have jail time and fines or you go to church. Go to church for a year, got to report, you got to talk to the pastor, got to report to the pastor, got to report, do all this stuff. Now, the ACLU of Alabama.
How can that be legal?
The ACLU is saying blatantly unconstitutional, but, you know, the people of Bay Minette, the police chief there, Mike Rowland, says, you know, our little program, restore our community. It's a good thing. He said it was agreed to by all the pastors. And at the core of the crime problem, he said, was the erosion of family values and morals. We have children raising children and parents not instilling values in our young people. So what they've done is they've said, okay, we're gonna produce productive citizens by making them go to church. And, you know, I was thinking about this, and I'm going, okay, there are no Muslims, there are no atheists, there are no other just Christian churches, because that's, I guess, all you have down in Alabama, just Christian churches. So what if you're not one of those? Do you then have to go to a Christian church so you can avoid jail? I don't know. The ACLU, you do know, will be filing a lawsuit, and there will be all kinds of hell to pay over this, because at the end of the day, this is basically institutionalizing a religion. This is government-run, government religion, no matter how you put up with it. But I love the response of Pastor Robert Gates. I'll play the good pastor.
You show me somebody who falls in love with Jesus, and I'll show you a person who won't be a problem to society, but that'll be an influence and a help to those around them.
Yeah, you show me somebody who loves Jesus, and he won't be a problem. Should we start with the Catholic Church first to kind of rebuke that, kind of to debunk that whole thing? All those priests over the years, should we start with that or no? Okay, we won't. We'll leave that out there because, well, I think we all give that, you know, where it belongs. So you go Tony Elmo. Remember back 2009, convicted 10 counts of federal taking children across state lines for sex? Remember him? Sentenced to 150 years. He loved Jesus. In fact, he talked about it all the time. Very, very popular guy. He was, you know, the head of the Santa Clarita commune. Big religious guy. Loved Jesus all the time. In fact, loved children a lot, too, literally. And will spend the next 150 years in jail. How about Wayne Bent? The guy, the founder of Lord Our Righteousness Church, convicted of sexual crimes against children, also the delinquency of a minor. He's going to do 18 years, in jail. What about the leader of the creative movement, a guy named Matthew Hale? 40-year prison term for soliciting an undercover FBI agent to kill a federal judge. Boy, these are just the pillars of society. You show me somebody who loves Jesus, and I'll show you a good person. Well, all these people, they claimed their love. They went to church every Sunday. In fact, they went to church Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday as well. How about this Jeffrey Lundgren, the head of the Reorganized Church of Jesus of Latter-day Saints? How about him? The guy who was executed back in 2006 for multiple murders. How about Fred Phelps? Do I need to say any more than Fred Phelps? Should we go any deeper than Fred Phelps? How about Jacques Robidoux, a leader of the Body of Christ Christian Church, serving time for first-degree murder, starved his son to death because God told him to do it. It was God's will. These are people who just love them some Jesus. And now we're going to take low-level criminals and make them feel the same way? I mean, it's nuts, isn't it? But on so many levels, it's wrong. I mean, now we've got government force-feeding religion? I'm scared. We are moving not only toward a corporatocracy, but a corporatocracy that's pushing theology. Is there such a thing in history as a corporate theocracy? Can that be? Can we have corporate-controlled religion that runs our government? Is that possible? I don't know. Anyway, let's take a quick break. We come back, Talk Radio News Service. Back after this.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Old washer or dryer on the fritz, and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. So again, the hostage situation has been averted. Now to help sort through it a little bit more is Justin Duckham, Talk Radio News Service. Justin, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, it's great to be here.
So again, another hostage situation averted.
That's what it looks like. The Senate today reached what appears to be a final deal to avert a government shutdown. What happened is there were two votes that went forward today. The first one was to keep the government funded until November 14th, and this was agreed to by a 79-12 vote. Following that, there was another voice vote to keep it officially funded until October 4th. And now both of these are going to be going to the Senate or to the House. And in the House, they can reconvene for a pro forma session and pass the October 4th bill with unanimous consent. And then after that, they will have a little bit of leeway to debate the longer bill that will fund it through November 14th. So it looks like that this is going to be something that's going to pass since it isn't too controversial now that some of the language regarding FEMA funding has been taken out of it.
You know, the sad thing is about this is, you know, none of this to me was controversial. There are folks who need help. We need to have the resources to help them here in central Pennsylvania. There are thousands of people who are going to depend on FEMA. If they don't have the money and I don't buy this, then, oh, well, we're good to the end of the week, maybe. But hell, you know, if something happens, oh, well, you know, we don't know. To me, this should have been just something very simple. And when Herman Cain begins to make sense, you know, I got a problem. I got a problem with the Republican Party.
No, that makes total sense. And, you know, this is something that has not been controversial until very recently with the rise of the Tea Party mentality. You know, never before have Republicans really demanded offsets for federal disaster relief. You know, the person who started moving for the offsets in the first place was Eric Cantor. And, you know, back earlier in the decade when his state was affected by, you know, natural disasters, he did not make these demands, but, you know, we are in a strange new world where this is going to be the norm from now on, it looks like.
But this bill that they've passed through, again, another deadline down the road, another potential hostage situation moving forward.
Yes, that unfortunately is what it looks like.
And what bothers me is, you know, you look at the rest of the world looks to us and goes, you know, what are you doing? This is the kind of stuff you would expect in some banana republic in the middle of nowhere, not the most powerful nation on earth. Why can't we get our stuff together?
You know, and there's also the economic argument that, you know, both parties have been trying to stress that the business community and, you know, our international partners are not encouraged by these little short-term advancements. They want to see something that shows that the U.S. is still going to be an economically viable partner, you know, in the future. And none of these really show that.
Well, what it shows me is it shows me that, you know, for the most part, And I'm going to blame the Republicans for this because this is their fault. This instance, absolutely their fault. I can get more compromise out of my three-year-old who's all sugared up and doesn't get a nap than I can get out of a Republican today.
No, they made some serious promises during the campaign that they did not quite, I guess, or they must have not understood how it was going to work out in real life. And now we are seeing, the real-life implications of this kind of, take no prisoners philosophy.
So now will they, the House has to come back? Have they left Washington?
The House has left Washington, but they just need to come back in a pro forma session, which, as I understand, means that they don't need to all be there for that. This could be a thing with just, several members, and they can just vote without unanimous consent. And as long as there's nobody there to object to it, it will move forward as law.
And when do they think is going to be the time frame on this?
Well, it needs to come pretty soon. It needs to come before Friday night. So it's looking like this could take place on Wednesday or Thursday.
Well, we shall see what happens. Justin, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much for the report.
Hey, it's great to be here. Have a good one.
All right, Justin Duckham, Talk Radio News Service. And now to find out what we've got going on across the street. What do you got for us tonight, Jake?
Yeah, thanks, Rick. Out of the Hill blog, there's an article on Facebook that we kind of touched on this last week, but they've apparently made it official. Facebook confirmed today it's filing paperwork on Monday to start its own political action committee. Creating a PAC is just the latest step in Facebook's continual expansion of its presence in Washington, but this is the first time the firm will back candidates. Facebook is likely to avoid the type of Washington scrutiny that has affected other firms like Microsoft and Google, which is currently under a FTC antitrust probe. The perception Google was previously sympathetic towards Democrats hasn't helped with the GOP in charge of the House. Facebook's lobbying spending has totaled about $550,000 for the year 2011, which is a significant boost over the $350,000 spent in 2010 and $200,000 in 2009. We'll just have to see what comes out of that. I'm not so sure where Facebook is going to come down and as to the type of candidates they're going to support, but it'll be interesting to sit back and see what comes out of that. Very interesting article on the war. The war drawdowns have tempted this super committee that we talk about that has been in charge of coming up with ways to balance the budget. There are some proposals to use the drawdown of the war as part of the savings. It's a move that has been dismissed as a budget gimmick, but it's also one that could make the super committee's job as a whole lot easier. Counting the savings of withdrawing troops from both Iraq and Afghanistan. But if the troops withdrawal is factored in, over $1 trillion in savings is there for the taking. Everything is on the table, according to Max Baucus, who's a Democrat from Montana on the committee. Given that the super committee must track down at least $1.2 trillion in cuts to avoid the triggering of automatic cuts, simply accounting for those savings would nearly get the panel there all by itself. House Speaker John Boehner has dismissed the president's accounting as just that, a gimmick. In July, the House Republican committee blasted that accounting move as phantom savings and a budget deception. Meanwhile, Senator Baucus's everything is on the table idea has become the mantra of the subcommittee as a whole. This, to me, is just amazing. On Thursday, 70 members of the House, including four Republicans, Rick, called on the supercommittee to find even more military savings by ending the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan altogether. The committee issued a public statement. This was their statement, quote, "Exorbitant spending on failed wars that have killed thousands of Americans must not be exempt from budgetary scrutiny. Before we act, ask American families to pitch in more. Let's bring our troops home and in the process our tax dollars home." And I say amen to that. Early in the day, Harry Reid had a problem in winning leverage with spending on this spending boat. He needed the support of Ben Nelson, which was the one Democrat who had voted against that proposal previously when it was voted on. He tried to get the vote of seven Republicans. One of them he already had, and that was Scott Brown. Later in the day, he was successful. However, it wasn't because Harry Reid persuaded him. Apparently, what had happened, the FEMA had said, after looking at their numbers, that they could come up with the numbers to last till the end of the year, and that was acceptable to the Republicans. However, you can rest assured that the Republicans and Democrats are going to be fighting on this issue as far as finding money. And with the Republicans asking the Democrats to cut back whenever they're asked to approve a budget, this time it was averted, and thank God. Pelosi and Reid are at odds with Obama over trade. Throughout the summer, Obama has been making the case that the trade accords with Colombia, South Korea, Panama will help the ailing economy by creating jobs. But Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid and House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi are disagreeing on that. Reid has a long track record of voting against free trade deals, including votes on U.S. agreements with Chile, Singapore in 2003, Dominican Republic, Central America, United States Free Trade Agreement, which is CAFTA, 2005, Oman in 2006, and Peru in 2007. Reid is also a strong supporter of organized labor. He lines up with the views of the AFL-CIO, which has said that similar deals like NAFTA cost nearly 700,000 jobs and have created a $97 billion trade deficit with Mexico. AFL-CIO President Richard Trumka has said the largest of the three trade pacts with South Korea will cost the U.S. approximately 159,000 jobs. The deal with Colombia will cost about 54,000 jobs. In 2008, Pelosi torpedoed fast-track authorization for the Colombian agreement, and that was the last lawmakers have seen of the agreement. California Democrat, she has supported deals with Peru, Singapore, and Chile, but has opposed CAFTA. She is supporting of more funds for infrastructure in the Chinese currency bill, both of which she has said will keep American workers on our shores. So, while Republicans press for completion of the Bush-era China tweak trade deals, Democrats, with along some of their GOP colleagues, are pressing for passage in October of a bill that would crack down on China's undervalued currency, a move that is opposed by the White House. So it'll be very, very interesting to see who wins out on that. So far, Harry Reid and Leader Pelosi have opposed it. When you listen to what they've said, under certain conditions, they might go along with that, but hopefully they'll hold their ground. Organized labor is, without question, opposed to these latest free trade agreements. Back to you, Rick.
All right, let's take a break.
Back to America. Rick Smith.
On June 25th, 1938, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt signed the Fair Labor Standards Act into law. Viewed as one of the final pieces of legislation of FDR's New Deal and the single most worker-friendly piece of legislation ever written, the Fair Labor Standards Act of 1938 was a victory not only for labor unions, but for workers, families, and children across the country. FDR called the new law the most far-reaching, far-sighted program for the benefit of workers ever adopted in this or any other country. This visionary piece of legislation put a ceiling over hours and a floor under wages, mandating a 44-hour work week, a 25-cent minimum wage, and time and a half for overtime. The Fair Labor Standards Act was later amended to 40 hours per week and 40 cents per hour. The law also excluded children from working dangerous jobs and set standard conditions for the employment of child workers to avoid continued exploitation of children. The Fair Labor Standards Act has been changed or amended at least 43 different times. These alterations have been used both to expand worker protections, such as raising the minimum wage, prohibiting age discrimination, and requiring equal pay, and to restrict and take away protections such as the Taft-Hartley Act and the 2004 Fair Pay Amendment. Today, we take the 40-hour work week, minimum wages, overtime, and child labor protections for granted. But up until the passage of the Fair Labor Standard Act, workers were at the mercy of their employers, and children were dying in industrial accidents. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Standing up to conservatives and corporatists every weeknight, The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. If you've got a question, comment, something on your mind, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Best way to get a hold of me. I do answer all emails personally. Also, if you missed any portion of our program, go to the website and download the podcast. Also, if you've got a smartphone, you could download the Stitcher app and take the program with you on the go. I was saddened to see the headlines today. Funk legend Sly Stone. Evidently, the Funk Master is living in a van on the edge of homelessness. And I'm going, how is it that someone made the kind of money that he made with all the hits that he had, all of the influence that he had, A Family Affair, Everybody, People, Thank You, all of those great songs. How this icon went from, you know, the top of the pinnacle of the mountain to now living in a little tag-along trailer on a side street somewhere in Crenshaw, California. Kind of makes you go, The recession is killing everybody. But they say his story, like many others, greedy manager, bad business deals, and, oh, yeah, all the stuff that went up his nose. He says he's not unhappy. He doesn't want to be at a fixed location. He likes moving around. So I guess, having the little tag-along trailer, I guess works for him. So good for Sly if that makes him happy. I feel sorry for him, though, man. You look at all of that wealth gone. Sad, sad, sad. I don't know if you saw it over the weekend, the satellite, some 6 tons of satellite came hurling toward the Earth. They say it probably splashed somewhere in the Pacific Ocean on the west end of the country here. Some of it may have hit Portland or Seattle or Calgary. They're not really sure. They're still trying to find pieces. I still like the idea of going up into space and putting foam all over the satellites so that when they bounce to Earth or when they bounce into each other, it's a softer blow. Because after all, I would much rather be killed by a falling satellite, surrounded by foam than a really rigid metal one, wouldn't you? The foam would just make it that much easier to take, I think. Andy Borowitz has a report on it. Evidently, evangelist Pat Robertson sparked controversy, broadcasting on his 700 Club program by saying that the NASA satellite plummeted to Earth, did so because God thinks satellites are gay. So what he's writing, the Reverend Robertson said, we have to remember that the heavens are where God lives. He went on to say, if we launch something into outer space and God thinks it's gay, he's going to kick it right back to us. Mr. Robertson offered a little evidence as to why God might think of the upper atmosphere this satellite was gay. He said it does have, I believe, a big telescope sticking out. And I could see why God would not want that in his face. He added that the falling satellite should serve as a warning to NASA not to launch other gay objects into space. The televangelist's remarks were abruptly cut short when a large piece of metal debris crashed through the roof of his television studio and landed squarely on his head. So there you go, the Borowitz report. We've got so much space junk up there. What happens when it all falls down? I always thought that they had to go up and bring it back down. Evidently not. Evidently it's just one big space junkyard. And we've done such a good job of polluting it that we actually have people who monitor when satellites are going to hit each other and when they're going to fall to Earth. That's how much junk we've put up there.
I believe some of that burns up also occasionally.
6 tons of it hit the ground. So some of it burns up, and some of it falls and hits people on the head sometimes. So there you go. I don't know if you saw this today, but Jerry Madden, who is considered a prison reform guru, he was in Harrisburg today. He was supposed to lead some bipartisan effort here. You know, we're trying to have some press conference. I didn't see it happening. Because they're saying that prison costs have spiraled out of control here in the state of Pennsylvania. And you look at this report by the folks at the Michigan Messenger, who reported on how the private prison industry has grown over the last decade. And pretty simple. It grew because it lobbied. And it lobbied to, you know, harsher sentences, more sentencing, mandatory sentencing, all of that stuff. In fact, you know, this Michigan Messenger has pointed out that in Michigan, I guess, the private prison population grew from over 87,000 to almost 130,000 from 2000 to 2009. And it shows that their lobbying efforts increased 165%, while their population grew by 37%. So all of that money that they're spending, the 840,000 to 1.4 million, paid off handsomely. So good times. The private prison industry doing quite well, and we're going to be talking about more of it here. Somebody told me today that Pennsylvania has, I think it was 17 public correction institutions, that we own 17 of these prisons, and at the private prisons, there are 47 here in the state. I didn't realize that there were that many privatized prisons already in the state of Pennsylvania. That's amazing to me. And I understand there's a bill in the state legislature trying to figure out how are we gonna bring down the prison costs. I think more privatization. Bread and water. We should do like the guy, Sheriff Lou. What's his name? Or Sheriff Joe. With the A. What's his name? Oh.
No, in Arizona.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know who you mean.
Put him out in tents. Give him pink underwear. Make them eat their food out of their hands. So there you go. Here's one of those great stories that you go, you know what? We should teach Republicans a lesson about capitalism. Evidently, they decided at the UC Berkeley, the Republican, the college Republicans there, that they wanted to have a increase the diversity bake sale, where they said that white men for any baked good would have to pay $2, Asian men would pay $1.50, Latino men would pay $1, black men would pay 75 cents, Native American men would pay $0.25 for any of the baked goods. And they're saying that they wanted to be racist because they wanted to prove a point. And what I was thinking, you know, instead of getting all upset that they're racist, because, look, they're Republicans. Come on. I think that's a foregone conclusion. I would have gone and gotten a Native American guy to go over and buy up all their stuff. Capitalism at work.
And then share their wealth.
And then eat it in front of them. Sounds irrational to me. But again, you know, we get too upset about stuff, and there was a whole big to-do. Oh, they're being racist. No kidding. Teach them a lesson. Go get a couple of Native American people, get some black guys to go over and buy them for $0.25, 75 cents, and resell them for $1. That's what the capitalists do. Anyway, I'm looking forward to the next couple of days. I think we're going to see where the state's going to go. There's talk about the voucher bill moving. There's talk of the privatization of the liquor stores moving. It'll be interesting as we move through this week to see what happens. Some of what I've been hearing also is that nothing is going to happen until the governor makes a move, because none of the Republicans want to get caught with their pants down on a bill that's going to smack him in the face. Look at Pileggi's election scheme. Look at this vote rigging scheme that he's going to get saddled with. And it couldn't happen to her, to, you know, a better party than the folks over there. Because, again, this is nothing but another massive overreach. And good for them. Because I think it wakes people up, and I think it's going to show exactly where that party is. So this week's going to be interesting. We'll see where things start to come out of committees when they come up for votes. It will be something. And of course, tomorrow between 4 and 5:30, find a congressional office. I think Holden's is right down here on Front Street. Go down, you know, tell him you want to save the post office, that he should sign on to the bill. I got to find out if he is. And we'll talk about that tomorrow as well. The voucher thing, the privatization of education schemes, all of this stuff. This is what we're going to be talking about this week. So have a great night. Get back here for the fight tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@therickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at therickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide of flood beneath the lunar sway. Imperial, mysterious, and amorous array. Democracy is coming to the USP.
It's The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.